challenged. It is generally accepted today that there is very little archaeological or historical evidence that confirms the stories of the Bible. Another scholar named Nadav Naaman, who is an Israeli professor from the Jewish history at Tel Aviv University, said it's commonly accepted today that the majority of the conquest stories in the book of Joshua are devoid of historical reality. And I could go on and on. One particular book by Matthew Sturgis and John McCarthy, it came out about a decade ago in 2001. It's called It Ain't Necessarily So. And I believe it came out right before or after the Bible Unearthed by Israel Finkelstein. And those two books really kind of set the tone for the last decade or so. On the Exodus, they wrote, "For them, that being the majority of scholars, in the absence of archaeological evidence, the Exodus, like the story of Joshua's conquest, remains an exploded myth. Concerning Jericho, they said, when the site at Jericho was reworked in the 1950s, for example, it was discovered that the walls had fallen down long before Joshua and his people were supposed to have arrived, and that at that time, Jericho was almost certainly unoccupied. The conquest of the Promised Land by the children of Israel began to evaporate into the thin hazy air. The fact that the archaeological evidence at Jericho and other sites mentioned in the Bible refutes the conquest story came as a shock. Archaeologist after archaeologist told me that not only was there no conquest of Canaan by Joshua and the children of Israel, that was all a later invention, but that the Israelites were in fact Canaanites. Concerning the conquest, they said, according to the latest count carried out by Bill Deaver and Lawrence Steger, of the 30 or so cities Joshua is said to have conquered, almost all of them were found to have been uninhabited during the 13th century B.C., the conventional date for the conquest, or destroyed by other agents or not destroyed at all. If the children of Israel did not sweep into Canaan and conquer it, did they ever escape out of Egypt and cross the wilderness? Indeed, were they ever in Egypt? Concerning the book of Judges, the notion that the early Israelites did not arrive as conquerors from outside the country, but emerged as settlers from within the indigenous Canaanite population is arresting. It seems, at first acquaintance, rather shocking, and as it sinks in, it seems more shocking. A God-given conquest of the Promised Land and a distinct racial identity as God's chosen people, these are the two great planks of Jewish tradition. Take them away, and it seems to realign radically the accepted story of the Old Testament. It undermines the entire dynamic of the biblical narrative, and it suggests that extreme caution must be exercised in attempting to use the book of Judges as a historical source." Thomas Thompson, who I've mentioned before, said, "The Bible's world does not belong to the discipline of archaeologists. It has never been found in any tell," and a tell is a ruin mound, "not even Jericho or Megiddo." And I could go on and on from there. That is the consensus view among archaeologists and historians, and has been for, and it's been gaining ground since the 1950s. And what happened in the 1950s is Dame Kathleen Kenyon went to Jericho and had a famous dig. She dug the famous trench that is, you can still see if you go there today. And she did a good job of finding all the stratified layers and identifying which period they belong to, whether the early bronze, middle bronze, late bronze, whatever. But she dated things about 150 years before the Bible did. And that was back when a lot of people were in agreement that if there was an Exodus, that it took place in the 15th century B.C., about 500 years before the time of Solomon. One of the quotes I mentioned, mentioned the fact that there was no conquest in the 13th century. And that's where we have two dates that are generally, for those who believe there is a conquest in Exodus, there are two primary dates that people believe. One, based on the Bible, is that it occurred 480 years before Solomon started building the temple, and that it took place around the mid-15th century B.C. The other one, that is probably the most popular among evangelicals and people of that stripe, is that it took place in the 1200s B.C. Now, there's one piece of evidence for that we're going to consider today in a little bit of detail. as we are able. So, what Kathleen Kenyon did, if when you lay all this out and look at it, the big picture, is her casting doubt on the story of the conquest provided scholars with what we can call a permission structure in which to minimalize the truth of what the Bible says and to slowly degrade it and denigrate it in the eyes of the public by and large. Now, this has been growing for the better part of a century, but her digs at Jericho were so widely published and widely followed that was everything that everybody needed who wanted to be a skeptic of the Bible in the first place. All right, let's turn to the book of Exodus. We'll be spending quite a bit of our time there. All right, Exodus chapter 1. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel who came into Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob. And it goes through the list of the tribes. Verse 8, then there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. Now this one verse has probably been the source of all the troubles regarding the chronology. What historians and archaeologists long realize is that when it comes to Egypt and Canaan or Palestine, the two are inseparable. You can't tell one story without the other. What happens in one affected the other. One strata in Canaan has to correspond to a certain strata in Egypt. Therefore, if you're going to try to rebuild their histories, then their chronologies need to link up. And Egypt is the most important chronology in scholarship. All of the ancient chronologies, whether you're talking about Greece, Assyria, the Levant, Anatolia, which is Turkey, Nubia or Kush, Ethiopia, which is south of Egypt, all of those ancient cultures are tied to the archaeology of Egypt. So if you get, by chance, the archaeology of Egypt wrong, as it pertains to chronology, then you are going to get everybody else wrong. The current Egyptian archaeology, a lot of people think it's set in stone, and it kind of is, but what we have from Egypt is haphazard. Sir Alan Gardner is an eminent Egyptologist from the 20th century. He probably died 50 years ago. But probably understood Egyptian hieroglyphics better than anybody. He famously wrote that what is proudly advertised as Egyptian history comes to us as a collection of rags and tatters. The reason for that is because you can go to Egypt, you can go to Greece, you can go to Turkey, you can go to Assyria, Babylon. None of those cultures left us anything like a coherent, sequential history like the Old Testament. Not a single one of them. What they do have from Egypt, though, is a ton of rags and tatters. The problem is, how do you piece all of that together? So identifying the cities of Pithom and Ramses are extremely important. And as we go through this, we'll try to piece some of this together. This is a quote that I had from a book, The Israelites in History and Tradition. Niels Peter Lemke said, the Israelite nation, as explained in the biblical writers, has little in the way of a historical background. It is a highly ideological construct created by ancient authors of Jewish tradition in order to legitimize their own religious community and its religio-political aims, claims on the land and religious exclusivity. This guy is Bill Deaver. He used to be on our side, actually. Sometime around 20, 25 years ago, he switched because the evidence against the historicity of the Bible was so overwhelming. This is a famous quote of his. No responsible scholar goes out with a trowel in one hand and a Bible in the other. All right, this is, you may not be able to read this too well, and I just didn't want to go to the time to create my own. But right along here, early bronze 1, 2, and 3, and early bronze 4. Then middle bronze 1, 2, and 3, late bronze 1 and 2, Iron Age 1 and 2. That's the way that the strata, if you start at the top of a tell or a ruin mound and dig down, you'll find iron first, and then you dig down. As you get down deeper, you get into early history. The yellow bar beneath it is the way the Egyptian Empire lines up. You have pre- and proto-dynastic, early dynastic. Then you have what's called the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, the Hyksos, and the New Kingdom, Third Intermediate Period. Then beneath that is basically this orange here is Mesopotamia for the most part, Babylon. And then below that you have Assyria, kind of northern Mesopotamia. The green is Hittite. And the brown is Greek. And what they've done here is kind of cool, because these empty spaces are where they have difficulty getting the archaeology to line up with the history. So here in Mesopotamia, for instance, in Babylon, and especially, surprisingly, Assyria. Now, they have the Greek Dark Ages here, and they have it colored in, which would make you believe that they actually have archaeology here, but actually this should be one of those empty spaces. What some scholars had noticed was there's all these inconsistencies in the archaeology of all of these cultures' timelines. For instance, whether you go to Greece, Assyria, Babylon, Ethiopia, south of Egypt, they have these really long dark ages. And just to verify it, I went through and read archaeological reports myself. And they claim to make what little archaeology they have fit these extremely long dark ages is they have to reduce population by 90%, which is bizarre. And just to put that in perspective, in the worst century in European history, the 1300s, with the bubonic plague, war, famine, disease, and all that kind of stuff, Europe lost about 50% of its population. But scholars would have us believe that Greece lost 90% of its population for the better part of 400 years. And then right here, when archaic Greece starts around 750, their population explodes back to Mycenaean Greek levels, just all of a sudden. And you can go around to all these different places. I read the reports myself, and it's amazing that it even makes sense to them that a population can be decreased by 90% in all of these cultures, and all are roughly at the same time. It actually blew my mind. I was reading a archaeological journal about Crete, on the island of Crete, and a guy was digging at a certain site, and in his report, he wrote, well, what he was finding was Mycenaean Greece ends on Crete, and then shortly thereafter, archaic Greece begins. That's what the strata was telling him. But he has to add in this Greek Dark Age. And he wrote, I don't really see any evidence for a Greek Dark Age, but I basically have to put it in there. The reason is because of all the Egyptologists. They're kind of the high priests of chronology. And if you make them mad and do something that messes with their chronology, then they're going to basically shout you down. So no matter where you look on this chart, the people that lived during those times no matter where you look on this chart, the archaeology does not make sense. And a group of Egyptologists were looking at the Third Intermediate Period. And you'll see here this timeline of Egypt there. After the Old Kingdom, you have the First Intermediate Period. They have it labeled Hyksos here. But after the Middle Kingdom, you have the Second Intermediate Period. Then you have this really long Third Intermediate Period. And what defines intermediate periods is a lack of centralized rule. There's usually more than one pharaoh. Egypt is divided up into regions. There's sometimes maybe three pharaohs. Towards the end of the period, when they were about to be conquered by Assyria, the Assyrians reported that there were 20 pharaohs. Now, that's probably a joke, because the way they wrote it is like, hey, when we went and conquered Egypt, weren't there something like 20 pharaohs or something like that? So they may have been exaggerating, but there is pretty good evidence that there were at least four. And if you read the book of Isaiah, he foretold that there was going to be civil war in Egypt, and that's exactly what the Assyrians were taking advantage of, was a massive civil war in the 670s, 660s, somewhere in that time period. So some Egyptologists were looking at the Third Intermediate Period there, and they came to some conclusions. By my count, there about 18 independent pieces of Egyptological evidence, whether inscriptions, statuary, all that kind of stuff, papyri, 18 different pieces of evidence that by themselves warranted a massive shortening of the third intermediate period. But when you take them as a whole, the case becomes exceedingly obvious that that's what needs to take place. Here's one piece of evidence called the Merintah Stele. And a lot of these are pictures from books I took, so they're going to be kind of warped a little bit. But the Merintah Stele, Merintah was the son of Ramses the Great, also called Ramses the Second. And right there, you read right to left, is Israel. And then this determinative here, which you can see they cartooned up here for you, means people or nation. Now, according to the conventional chronology, Merintah is around 1200 BC. Well, if you believe that the Exodus occurred in 1200, 1250, 1240, somewhere in there, you're saying, okay, we're okay on our chronology, except this is not the determinative in Egyptian hieroglyphics for a tribal people. This is the determinative for a proper nation, which the Egyptians would not have considered the Israelites shortly after the Exodus to be a proper nation. This is the Berlin pedestal, and this is one of the things that really throws a chink in the conventional chronology. It's inscribed with the name rings of Ashkelon, Canaan. Here's Ashkelon, Canaan, and Israel. Now, this is the real one, and you can see it's broken off, but reconstructed, it looks like this. And these letters are pretty obvious to Egyptologists. They're all in agreement that this says Israel. This came from a couple hundred years before. So in the conventional chronology, we're already in the 1300s, maybe even the 1400s. Well, even in our chronology, if you go with Edwin Thiele, this starts to not make sense. It just doesn't fit quite right. Then we have this depiction of an enemy chariot at Karnak, and I'm going to show you kind of a reconstructed version of this, but this big wheel is Pharaoh's chariot, and these are the back legs of Pharaoh's horse. And then these little horses are his enemies. He's about to run them over. Of course, this is Ramses II. And I put late LB up there for late Bronze Age because this is going to be kind of important. This is a close-up. You can see this is the enemy's. I'll use this for laser pointing. There we go. You can see this is the enemy's horse. And this horse is weary. He's defeated. His head's down and everything. And he's about to get trampled. This is the Isbet Sarta Ostrakon. This is the Hebrew's ancient alphabet. And it's very different from the one that you see if you were to open up a Hebrew Torah scroll today. That's the Aramaic alphabet, which they adopted during the captivity. I'm going to point this is Aleph and Beit. That those actually, if you know, study this close enough, you can see the beginning of our alphabet, because this is where ours came from. You can see this D here, shape here. We turn it sideways. But right here is where it gets, and I don't know how well you can see that. I've got another graphic that shows it better. But this is basically what a boy scratched in, probably while he was learning the alphabet. We have Kaf and Resh, which at this time, that's what they used. And over here, we have Wav. We'll come back to that in just a minute. So here's Ramses' temple at Abu Simbel. Here's the statues that you just saw. And you walk inside, you turn left, and all along these walls here, he tells a story. And once you get to this corner over here, you get to this chariot scene. And this is a photo of it, and it's kind of rough. I'll show you a better version of it. There's Ramses. There's his sons. He had many of them. There's his sons following him into battle, and he's got his triumphant chariot horse there. And this is kind of a stylized version of it so that we know what we're looking at. And these are all the hieroglyphics. And what he's doing is he is conquering a city in the mountains. Now, you can see the color. He's red. And his sons and their chariot drivers are red. And then you got these yellow-skinned people over here with funny hair and beards. Yellow is the color that Egyptians always use for Asiatic people. So here you've got this city. in the mountains. Where the cartouche for naming this city should be, there is none. They never either finished it, or they never meant to finish it, or the identity of this city was so obvious to Ramses and his artists that they didn't feel necessary to put it in. Now that becomes important for what we're about to consider now. Because we're told who was the first pharaoh named in the Bible? Shishak, yes. It was Shishak. He's the first king, first pharaoh that the Bible names. Now in the 1820s, about 1840, a famous Egyptologist named Champollion, and he's the one that translated the Rosetta Stone, and that's how we began to understand Egyptian hieroglyphics. He took one trip to Egypt his entire life. He went to a place called Bubastis, and he found the Bubastis portal, and he found a campaign list of a pharaoh named Shoshank. And he saw what he thought was Judah the kingdom. If you look right here, I'll read it for you. Number 29 on this map says Yad HaMelech, and it's right up in this area. He translated it as Yada or Yuda Melech, Judah the kingdom. So he put this together with the invasion of Rehoboam and the sacking of Jerusalem and said, Shoshank is Shishak. And even though within a few years, about a decade or so, that translation of Yad HaMelech was debunked, the association of Shoshank with the sacking of Jerusalem has been a building block of Egyptian chronology and therefore Israel's chronology. And Shoshank is in the third intermediate period. He's from the 21st dynasty, which is the first dynasty. He's actually the founder of the 21st dynasty. So he's an extremely important person in chronology. But these right here represent the fortified cities of Rehoboam, which are listed for us in 1 Kings. The fortified cities of Rehoboam. And of course, you can kind of tell he's preparing for an assault from Egypt. He's worried about the southwest. Jerusalem is about right here. So all of these cities he fortified. This is Shoshank's campaign list. The only city on Shoshank's campaign list that appears in the list of fortified cities of Rehoboam is number 14, Aijalon. And if you look at Shoshank's campaign, he begins here, skirts Judah. He does capture Aijalon because it sits on the road of where he's going. Then he gets up here into the Jordan Valley. He actually splits his forces, and he does kind of a circle around the northern kingdom of Israel. Ramses also has a campaign list that he foretook going into Canaan land. And right here, this red is Shoshank's that I just kind of showed you. And here is Ramses. Ramses splits his forces and goes gets the Amalekites because the Egyptians hated them. And also probably to secure his flank. And then he sends his one force this way and one force this way, and then they meet here. Jerusalem is right here on his campaign trail. And in his campaign list, he says that one of the cities he conquered was Shalim. Obviously, Jerusalem is Shalim. So Ramses conquered Jerusalem. Shoshank avoided Judah like the plague. And there's no other campaign list for Shoshank into that part of the world. So Shoshank, who people think is Shishak, avoided Judah and went around Israel. Ramses did a circumnavigation of Judah, and that included the city of Jerusalem. This is Megiddo. And a couple years ago, I was given a class on Isaiah at Smart Road, and I was showing them pictures of all this stuff on this upper part of the tell, because it's Iron Age, and that's what I had always been told was the era of Solomon. We're going to consider some things down in this area, which is the late Bronze part of Megiddo. And the reason this is important is because Ramses is in the late Bronze Age. If he is the conqueror of Jerusalem when Rehoboam, in Rehoboam's fifth year, then that means Solomon is in the late Bronze Age and not the Iron Age. I showed him the so-called Solomonic gates of the Iron Age city, and I forgot one critically important architectural detail that is mentioned when it talks about Megiddo and Solomon's building concrete. What you see here, this is a basalt foundation stone. But it mentions when the cities were being built that there were one, two, three tiers of cut stone or ashlar blocks, and then cedar beams. This is Phoenician-style building, and what the cedar does is it acts like shock absorber for earthquake protection. This is Phoenician architecture, of course, who famously built the temple, or at least oversaw the work in all of his cities. It was the Phoenicians because they were a much more advanced culture than the Israelites, at least when it came to architecture and building. The Late Bronze Age is the only time that this type of architecture appears in Israel. It's the only time. And of course, we know that Hiram became friends of David, and then that friendship transferred to Solomon. So that by itself is enough for me to date Solomon to the Late Bronze Age, and those upper Iron Age strata have to come later, such as during the time of Ahab, and then even later, Jeroboam II. One of the things that Solomon was famous for was ivory. It talks about his ivory and how much ivory he brought in. This is from the Megiddo ivory hoard, and it was found in the Late Bronze Age levels. Over 600 pieces of ivory, and it's actually fantastic. This is a board game. Nobody knows how to play it, but they assume it's a board game. This is an ivory comb. This is a fantastic piece of a mythological creature. And there's some obvious signs that Solomon was falling into paganism. This is a woman or a priestess or something. This is another mythological creature. This piece right here is extremely important. Archaeologists think it probably came off a chair or a bed, or it was probably affixed to a piece of furniture overlaying a piece of wooden furniture. We'll zoom in on a certain section of it. These are doves. There's another one up here I cropped out. What are doves symbolize? What's Solomon's name mean? Shlomo means peace. This is his wife bringing him lotus flowers. Where do you famously find lotus flowers? Egypt. This is a sphinx. What does the Bible say we're surrounding Solomon's throne on either side of his throne? Lions. The Hebrews didn't have a word for sphinx, so they probably would have just called it lions. I'm going to go on a limb here and say that this ivory hoard is Solomon's, and that this is, in fact, a depiction of Solomon. This is his Egyptian wife. The symbolism with the doves is quite obvious. Here we have a very rich and powerful king, because this soldier here is bringing him a horde of slaves from a victorious battle. So I'm going to assume that this is Solomon from the Late Bronze Age, which fits with the archaeology. And his Egyptian wife. This is a picture I took from an article. This is the city of David. Here's the Temple Mount. You may remember 1 Kings 9:24 says, after Pharaoh's daughter had moved from the city of David up to the palace which he had built for her, he, being Solomon, then built Millo. He actually goes on to say he moved her out of the city because he didn't want her to be an offense to the people. Well, to get up from the Temple Mount, to go up from the Temple Mount, the only place up is these hills here. This is actually higher elevation. So the Zion, or the city of David, is lowest, then Moriah, and then this area up here. This square is where some interesting finds have been made over the last couple decades. Here's the city of David, here's the Temple Mount, and here's what's called the Garden Tomb. Here's St. Stephen's Church. Right here around the Garden Tomb is a Greek Orthodox monastery called St. Etienne's. And they found some interesting things in their garden. Let me make sure it didn't. This is an upside-down pillar, Egyptian pillar, and it's been used as the corner of a retaining wall for a garden. Flip it upside down, it's the capital. And it is a Ramesside 19th dynasty capital. Archaeologists don't doubt that. They can tell by the style of it. So Ramses, 19th dynasty. Here we have also, they don't call 19th dynasty, but it is New Kingdom. This is Ramesside. This is also New Kingdom. So time period of the 19th dynasty in Ramses. This is a tomb. This is a tomb. I think we actually uploaded a different slide presentation. We'll fix it at the break. This is inside a tomb, which was inside the monastery of Saint Etienne. And it was actually behind their altar. You know how the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics, they have their little chapel area with an altar. Well, behind was an open space, and they let archaeologists tear through it. And they found first an antechamber, and then they found these funeral beds. And this is pretty typical of the Israelites. It's a bed where you laid out the body. Over here, I didn't have a picture of it, but there's a hole for the body fluids to drain out. And then they would take the bones and sweep them into this area here. So they buried people here for quite a while, although there's obviously no way to know who. But in the farthest recesses of the tomb are three beds with these, what they call Hathor headrests. And we're going to meet Hathor. But Hathor is an Egyptian goddess. And they did something different because they mummified their bodies. They didn't have the holes for the body fluids to drain. So they would mummify the body and lay the head there. There were places for three Egyptians. One, you can probably guess, a parent, and probably two children or two relatives or preferred slaves. These are the only Egyptian. I mean, they'll find scarabs. They found some scarabs and things like that. But these are the only truly Egyptian artifacts that Egyptians would have used on a daily basis or for remembering their dead that have ever been found in Jerusalem. And the only famous Egyptian to ever move and live in Jerusalem is, of course, Pharaoh's daughter, whom Solomon married. Tell you what. I had two versions of this because it crashed, and so I had to do an autosave. Why don't we go ahead and take a short break now, and then we'll gear up, and I'll conclude those arguments, and then we'll get going for sure. So here we're back at this Isbet Sarda Ostrakon. It has the ancient Paleo Hebrew alphabet on it, and if you'll recall, I had pointed out the Kaf and the Rosh and the Wav. Of course, the Kaf becomes our Q, and the Rosh becomes our R. You can kind of see the beginnings of those. Has anyone ever taken a look at the original Epic of Beowulf? It's written in the 9th or 10th century AD. It's written in English, and it's like a foreign language. It uses our alphabet, and it's our language, but none of us would understand it. We need a translation. Well, all languages do that. They all change over time. Alphabets change over time. And the alphabet that Hebrews used was no different. There's a theory that when Josiah found the book of the law, and this is part of the documentary hypothesis, and I think there's something to it. When Josiah found the book of the law and it was read to him and he tore his clothes, that they updated, under Josiah's direction, the entire corpus of what they had that would become the Old Testament. And the language had changed quite a bit. Now here is Shishak. Shin, Yod, Shin, Kof. Several hundred years earlier, Sin, Yod, Sin, Wav. So the Wav had changed. Remember, it kind of looked like a sideways W. So Shishak may have looked like this when it was originally written, and when Josiah's scribes translated it, not knowing any different, they translated it Shishak with a cough. And look how close those are. I mean, it'd be pretty easy for a scribe who's not using one of these letters dropped out to make a mistake in that line. So the biblical Shishak may have actually been Sisu or Shishu or something along those lines. We don't actually know how they pronounced the vowels back then. So that's what I was meaning to show you, is that we may have an indication here because Ancient languages are interesting, especially when they use different writing systems, because when you're translating a language or a name or a word, and the other languages uses a different writing system than you, what you do is you just translate it or write it as you hear it. So, what we see as Ramses, the Akkadians, they used a syllabic syllabic writing system, so it had the vowels. So we see Ramses, the Akkadians saw Riamashisha, Riamashisha. This right here would be the spelling of Shisha in the Old Hebrew. Oh, this one's not working. This is Shisha in the Old Hebrew language, probably from the time that Solomon would have been using it. So there is some evidence there, some more weight. So here we are at the temple again. Ramses conquering. There's the campaign list of Shoshank. Shoshank and Ramses side by side. Megiddo. The ivories. This is where I was for sure that we were messed up. There we go. All right, that's the entrance. There's the altar that I was telling you about. And you see that hole where they allowed the archaeologists to tear through there. Then that's going into, and that's looking back out. There's the Jewish or Israelite sarcophagus, and there's where we kind of left off. Another piece of evidence is the Seti Stele. It was found in Beth Shan. And he mentions in it that he conquered Gezer. Now that's important because Solomon's father-in-law did what with Gezer? He conquered it and gave it to his daughter as a dowry. Well, Seti in this Stele lists several cities that would correlate to the Jezreel Valley, including Gezer. And he's appropriate to this time period, obviously, because he is the father of Ramses the Great of the 19th dynasty. So we have a bunch of circumstantial evidence starting to pile up here. I could go on and on about that. There's, like I said, there's about 18 to 20 pieces of evidence. So these Egyptologists, they hashed out what they think is the third intermediate period. And what that does is, imagine standing at 0 BC and looking back in time. You've got all these different cultures, all these different chronologies, but you've got this overextended third intermediate period for Egypt, and all of those cultures' chronologies are tied to Egypt, but now you have the evidence to take a hook and a line, throw it out, and drag it all forward. Now, when you do that, the only thing that stays in place is the Bible's chronology. Starting with Solomon building the temple. Now, this is going to kind of be hard to read, but I couldn't find a better one. So I took a picture of a page in a book I had. But this is the earliest, and then it goes up as you get closer to our time period. So this is 1800, 12th dynasty. Then you have Joseph, second intermediate period. Here's the time period of the sojourn. Here's the 18th and 19th dynasty. This is in the conventional scheme. All of this gets moved up until Joseph is now in the 12th dynasty, and everything follows after that. All right. I think that's enough introduction. I think what we should do is get to the meat of it. Is there any questions or comments before? All right. I focused on three basic time periods. Because if you look in the Bible, there are three figures who would have definitely left an archaeological footprint, if any. The first one being Joseph, the second one being Joshua, and then a Solomon, which we've talked about a little bit already. The reason I did that is because you have to leave an archaeological footprint for someone to find you in history. Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty of this, I just want to remind you that by and large, archaeology can only provide a context for the truth. It's not going to usually confirm it. So, for instance, we're not going to find a Bronze Age gate in the middle of the Negev that says, you know, I, Samson, tore this from Gaza and marched it into the highlands. That's probably not going to happen. But you can find a permissible context for the events of Genesis and Exodus and so on and so forth to take place. If you go to archaeology of the 12th dynasty, which is in the Middle Bronze II period, and we'll keep coming across Middle Bronze II as we go through this, there's a place called Beni Hassan. And the Beni Hassan is a group of tombs of Egyptian powerful men that are called nomarchs. And if you read about Egyptian history, you'll find out that the nomarchs were like tribal, local chieftains, governors, princes, that kind of thing. And during the 12th dynasty, they were extremely powerful and extremely wealthy. Their tombs, while they weren't allowed to build pyramids themselves, were extremely rich. This is a painting on the tomb. This is the painting on the tomb of a nomarch at Beni Hassan. His name was Khnumhotep. And what we see here are Canaanites coming to Egypt. Remember, the Egyptians are red. Asiatics, Canaanites, Syrians, those people are always yellow. What are the Canaanites wearing? They're wearing the bling, aren't they? They're wearing coats of many colors, you might say. A couple, 100, 200 years after this, the Canaanites stop wearing this kind of clothes. And it's because they go through a relatively poor period. But during the 12th dynasty, Canaan is very rich. And of course, you can probably tell where I'm going with this coat of many colors thing. Now, when you see a statue of an Egyptian pharaoh, they usually look something like this. This is one of the first from the Old Kingdom. This is Khafre's. And he's pleasant looking. This is, I believe, Thutmose. And he's kind of smiling. When you find a statue of a pharaoh, that's typically how they look. They're either smiling or they look placid. There's an interesting time period in Egyptian history. This is Senusret III and Amenemhat III. They're from the 12th dynasty, Middle Bronze period 2. And they're the only kings in Egyptian history that we know of that are depicted wearing frowns. You can see the worry lines under their eyes. They both have their ears turned out as if to hear the cries of their people. Their stomachs are drawn a little bit gaunt. These guys are worried about something. This is not the Nile River below the Second Cataract, so we're very far south in Egypt, and there's these interesting forts that straddle a gorge called the Semna Gorge. Here is the one on the east bank, and here's the one on the west bank. This is the east bank. I think I got this picture upside down. But these are the ruins, and the Nile passes through this gorge. And here's an artist's version of it. So you have Semna and Kuma. You probably can't tell there, but that's a boat on the Nile. Well, what would happen is the Nile would inundate each year, and these soldiers and an official would come out here on the boats, and they would ride up these cliffs, and they'd make a mark where the inundation crested. And the reason is this. We're in the 17th century, the early 1600s. Remember, the numbers go reverse of what we're used to. All these black, they represent markings that we've discovered. And the gray represent markings that we're able to extrapolate. The blue in between, we can't find at all because as the cliff face eroded, the markings left. But these are from the reign of Amenemhat III in his third year, and he and his father had a co-regency. They go all the way through at least Sobekhotep I of the 13th dynasty for the better part of two-thirds of a century or so. And you can see what happens to the flood level of the Nile. So it's going up, and then it goes way up before it drops back down. This right here is the modern flood level at the gorge. So, what's all that about? Well, if you're dependent on the Nile for your farming, you might say that these represent good floods. At least that's what the Egyptologists say, is these represent good floods. And these, extremely high, these are plus 20 meters of extra water. Those would be catastrophic, and they actually continue pretty high for quite some time. So too much water is a bad thing because If it takes the inundation too long to drain out, then you can't plant, get your crops in. That's going to cause famine. What they did, what Amenemhat III did, you've probably seen this when you're looking at a map of Egypt. You've seen this little area here that kind of shoots off. This is called the Fayum Basin, and that's actually the lake right there. The Egyptians called it Pa Yam. And there's this waterway that shoots off the Nile here, along here, and then it takes a left turn at Lahoon, and it enters this basin. And what it did was, this was a canal that the Egyptians dug, and it's pretty amazing. It's like 0.1 inch per 100 feet along the entire, so amazing engineering. And it empties into this basin. And an Egyptologist was working with a mathematician to figure out how much water it could hold, because we know where the shoreline of it was when it was full. And they, going back to this, their agreement was that it could have taken about half of the extra water when it was operable. About half of the extra flood water. And then there was a mechanism that once the inundation was over, they could slow release it throughout the course of the rest of the year. An amazing feat of engineering. And this is probably what saved them from the extremely high inundations. To this day, it's called the Waterway of Joseph. And as far as any evidence we have, going back hundreds of years, almost actually about 1,000 years, it has never been known by any other name. We don't have any other record in Egypt of it. So it's always just been called the Bar Yosef, or the Waterway of Joseph. There's a romantic sunset picture of it. But along the entire length, it drops about 0.1 inch every 100 feet. This is Amenemhat III's labyrinth. That's obviously not a photo of it. But Herodotus actually visited this thing. And there's the pyramid. Nobody actually knows what it is. They've speculated that it's a mortuary temple where his body would have been prepared. But it's not built like any other mortuary temple. In fact, it has 30 segments in it. And Egypt has 30 nomes. There's actually a second subterranean level. And Herodotus considered it one of the... he almost considered it one of the wonders of the ancient world. But he wrote about it pretty extensively. Some people speculate that it may have been a grain distribution center. Also, the people that built his second pyramid, he built two pyramids. One was called the Black Pyramid, and at this time they were making them out of mud bricks, and it collapsed, or started to collapse, so he gave it to his wife. And he had his favorite work crew build him a second one. And this is an interesting little work crew, this worker's village here, because they eventually walled it up, which is not something that's typical of these types of settlements. We'll come back to that eventually, but we know that it was filled with Asiatics or Semites. Here's the layout of it. Here's where the upper-class people lived, and here's where the workers lived. And, of course, they were walled in. Here's another drawing of it from long ago. And it was looking directly at his pyramid. I had another slide I was going to show here, but around this time, once the flood levels start leveling off, I'm going to go ahead and call this Jacob's Syrian-style house, because in a city called Avaris, and if you look on this map, shoot back here real quick, you'll see this place called Hawara, or Havara, and that's the way the Egyptians pronounced it. The Greeks called it Avaris, so we'll stick with that. Yes. I'll have a better map. In the eastern delta, this Syrian-style house was built at a place called Avaris in what the Egyptians called the district of Ka Sin. And Ka Sin is cognate to what the Hebrews would call Goshen or Goshen. This Syrian-style house was surrounded by a small settlement that archaeologists say could have housed about 70 to 100 people. And shortly after that time period, that house was demolished, and a palace was built on top of it. And this is the original archaeologist diagram.
It's in two phases. This phase up here was built second. This phase right here was built first. As you went inside this portico, this was the main audience chamber, wardrobe, washroom. Right here is the bedroom, and right this little square right here is the largest bed ever discovered in the ancient world so far. Kind of interesting. But what's really got me intrigued is this front portico has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 pillars. And there's another drawing of it. This part was built second. In fact, this patio was closed in. And there's the 12 pillars. And there's a rendering of what it may have looked like during his lifetime. And then this is curious, too, because there are 12 monumental graves. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, in shadow, 9, 10, 11, 12. And this one is really curious. Up until this point, pyramids were always the reserve of kings and queens. This is the earliest known mini-pyramid in history. Now, during the time of the New Kingdom, they're going to become quite popular. They were still commissioned by pharaohs, but pharaohs would just give them to, you know, high priests, favored generals, relatives, and things like that. But this is the earliest known miniature pyramid in the history of Egypt. So whoever owned this house was extremely important to the Egyptians, because only the pharaoh could commission this. You can see, you would enter this, they call it a chapel. I may have missed some slides there. And we'll see a statue that was built. And the statue was studied by a gal, an Egyptologist, who was getting her PhD in art, Egyptian art, and Middle Kingdom art, to be exact. And she determined that it was actually hammered out in the very workshops of Amenemhet III in Hawara, the middle part of Egypt at the Fayum there that I showed you earlier. So here we have this mansion for an important Egyptian official. It's got a patio fronted with a 12-pillared portico, and there's 12 monumental graves in the back, one of which is the first miniature pyramid for a non-Egyptian royal that we know of. This is how the Asiatics buried themselves, and this was one of the early indications among the archaeologists that they were dealing with non-Egyptians, because Egyptians don't bury their people on their sides in a semi-fetal position. And they were always buried facing east, so they were facing home. Egyptians, you know, they bury people on their backs. This is actually from one of those chieftain tombs that we just looked at. And this right here would be cleaned up and be a magnificent copper belt. They were very rich. This was a dagger that was found in one of the chieftain tombs. And this is a drawing of the copper belt. You can see the style and the engravings there. There were weapons in the tombs, duckbill axes and daggers. Very wealthy people were buried in those tombs. So who was buried in this one? When they took some scraps of the statue that they found and put them in a computer and started wrangling with it, they had something like this. He's wearing a many-colored coat. He's got a throw stick over his shoulder, which is a symbol of Asiatic. He's got red hair, which is interesting when you consider Edom and David was also called Ruddy, maybe an indication that they were red-haired. And he's got yellow skin like an Asiatic. I want to read something. There was one of the Egyptologists that was working on this 20 years ago. I'll just read what he wrote. What about Joseph's Egyptian name? Zaphnath-Paneah. In respect of the first element, Zaphnath, we have here an example of metathesis, where the letters T and P have been reversed, because Zaphnath in Egyptian doesn't make any sense. This is a regular, though unintentional, practice which occurs when difficult words and names are transferred from one language into another. So Egyptologists switch them. Instead of Zaphnath, it's Zat in Af, which in Egyptian means he who is called, which is a similar phrase among Egyptologists. So the expression Zaphnath in Genesis 41, 45, Pharaoh named Joseph, he who is called Paaneah. The second element in Joseph's Egyptian name, Paaneah, is fairly straightforward. It has been long been recognized that Aneah represents the Egyptian word Ankh, meaning life, or Ankhu, meaning is alive. So Joseph's Egyptian name is either Paankh, meaning the life, or Paankhi, meaning the living, or the one who is alive. Kitchen, who's an Egyptologist, proposes that the initial Pa element stands for Ipi or Ipu. Thus, we discover that the Asiatic vizier of Egypt was given the name Joseph, who was called Ipiankhu or Piankhu. The practice of giving foreigners Egyptian names is very common in this period and is especially notable in the papyrus Brooklyn, which we're going to look at here in a little bit. Whereas we have already noted, we find a number of Asiatic slaves whose Egyptian names were preceded by the phrase, he or she who is called. He goes on to write, it is interesting to note also that the hyperisticon Ankhu is very common at this time and may be another disguise in which the historical Joseph could be hidden. So perhaps, this was written in 1995, so perhaps we should be looking more widely for a vizier called Ankhu rather than the fuller form Ipiankhu. Unfortunately, as yet, we have no names which we can directly associate with the vizierate in the reigns of Amenemhat III, IV, the Pharaoh Sobek, and so on. Fast forward a decade or so, and we come across this. This is a stela, and it's for the vizier Ankhu, and they've been able to trace him through several monuments from the 12th dynasty. He took over as the vizier in about the 9th or 10th year of Amenemhat III, and he is the vizier of Egypt into the 13th dynasty. He has an exceedingly long reign. He has two sons, Renseneb and Ameru, who succeed him to the viziership. And that's what's interesting about this, is because we don't know who his father was, but if he was given the viziership, he was probably adopted by the previous vizier, because all of these titles and jobs were family affairs in ancient Egypt. So he was likely adopted, if indeed this is Joseph. And Ankhu had an amazing career. We have inscription evidence that mentioned the storehouses or the grain houses of Ankhu. Once they found this stela, and they started finding him kind of everywhere, and it's always in the Middle Bronze Age, 12th Dynasty, into the 13th Dynasty. He had an incredibly long viziership. How old was Joseph when he died? 110. There were at least four times after this time period where Egyptians wrote, whether on papyrus or an inscription, that 110 is the ideal lifespan. This is one of the statue of one of his sons, Imeru, his second son. His oldest son, Renseneb, followed him, and shortly after, and we're in the 13th dynasty, the 1580s, somewhere around there, Renseneb was raised to the pharaohship, probably to honor his family's service to their country. We'll talk a little bit more about them, but he only reigned for about 4 months before he died of old age. He didn't survive his father, but by a year or two. Egyptologists think that this Imeru is also this guy. And this is a statue of Imeremishaw, and they think Imeru is a hypercharisticon of his real name. They also lean towards this being a son of Ankhu. And his statue here has kind of a sad history, because later pharaohs kept using it for themselves and carving their own cartouches on it. But his cartouche is still visible on it, and it's actually kind of traveled the world, so a little bit ironic. But what Egyptologists think is, after the 12th dynasty, Amenemhat III is the most powerful pharaoh of the 12th dynasty. His reign comes to an end. He's followed by short reigns from his son and daughter. And then they begin what's called the 13th dynasty. And Egyptologists, piecing this 13th dynasty intermediate period together, believe that this family of Ankhu came the true powers behind the throne. They even speak of it being a dynasty of viziers. The other thing that they've noted is that the Asiatic community at Avaris takes off, and they become even more rich and powerful. There's a camp of workers. They're Asiatics. They all have Semitic names, who were given preferential treatment. You'll remember when Jacob's family moved into Goshen, the Pharaoh gave them jobs, didn't he? And he said, I'll set you over my herds. So this Asiatic community gets preferential treatment. They get the best jobs. They grow exceedingly rich. And what Anku's family does is they actually start dividing Egypt. And Egyptologists think it's to keep themselves in power. But they actually divide the delta into two, and they have an eastern delta pharaoh and a western delta pharaoh, and there's a southern pharaoh as well. But as far as we know, they all recognized Anku and his sons as the viziers. They married into the royal family, and it all gets kind of confused from there. Now, if you look at Egypt, Egyptians, they all have black hair. Ramses is from Goshen. In fact, he renamed it the land of Ramses after himself. And when his mummy was discovered, they marveled at his copper red hair. And his family was a military family from the area of Avaris. I would posit that his family had probably intermarried with these Asiatics, who I'm going to go ahead and call the Israelite Hebrews, descended from Jacob. And so Ramses may very well be a descendant of Abraham as well. This is what Avaris looks. Remember that little cow town that I dubbed Jacob's palace? This is what it looked like in the 13th dynasty. Guess where the Egyptians lived? They know where the Egyptians lived because the Egyptians plastered their houses. And this is where the Asiatics lived, who would be the Hebrews. Right here is a temple. And right here is the palace of Pharaoh himself. And I remember reading a book when I was young, like late 80s, early 90s. I was early teenager. And I remember reading something that a scoffer was writing. And it was about the story of Moses and the basket and the Nile and all that stuff, and Pharaoh's daughter finding it. And it's kind of funny because this is what they've reconstructed as Avaris to be. And you can see here, this coastline goes right up to the back steps of the Pharaoh's mansion there on the Nile. But this is what happens in the Delta. So you start off with this community in Avaris. This dot here probably represents Pithom. But it explodes with these Asiatic communities. Now, they're excavating Pithom. There's a good chance that these will never get fully excavated, so we will never know how big these were and what the overall population looks like at this time. But it does definitely explode. How they discovered this is there's different stages of archaeology, and one is called a sounding. That's where you go to a likely site, and you just dig a trench 1 meter by 1 meter, and you go down until you run into bedrock or obvious no human habitation. And they found the strata that represents these Asiatics from the 12th and 13th dynasty. So they literally fill the land of Goshen. So, for the skeptics, it's been said that the Exodus is not a historical event, that the Hebrews were never there in the number described, and yet the city of Avaris in the Egyptian Delta grew with great speed to be one of the biggest cities in the ancient world. Population estimates at its peak in the 13th dynasty placed it at anywhere between 25 and 30,000 people. Probably about 80% of those people would have been Israelites, or at least Semitics. It had a large Semitic-speaking population right around the time that the Bible places Israel in Egypt. Can that possibly be coincidence? I would say no. So here's another view of Avaris when I was taking my helicopter tour of the Delta. It was lovely weather. This is the opposite end of the city. There's the temple and there's the palace district. And as you can see, if you're Pharaoh and you step out of your palace there and you look around, you're surrounded by Semites. Remember what he was afraid of? Israel, the Israelites or Hebrews joining with their enemies. That's where all those connected areas come into play. So you're surrounded literally by the Hebrews. Here's another view. Here's the temple. Here's the palace of the Pharaoh. You can literally walk out the back door down this ramp. And that's probably the spot right there is where I'm guessing where Pharaoh's daughter found Moses. It's interesting how things changed. During the earlier period, they were very rich. They had the best jobs. They had the best of the land. They developed the land of Goshen. And then the population all of a sudden takes a sudden turn, and they start noticing that the population is malnourished. They start dying younger. Now, if you go to cemeteries anywhere in the ancient world, start digging, about 25% of the graves will be infant burials. And that goes up into the 1800s of the United States. About 25% of burials were infants. At Avaris and at that other place, Havara, which we'll visit again, the workers' town that I showed you, infant burials shoot up to about 50% of the burials. Now, there's no way to determine gender for infants that young, but this is one that was found. Oops. In Avaris, they buried them in ceramic or jars, and there's an egg there for size comparison. And in Cahoon, that workers' town I showed you, they buried them in in wooden boxes, and then buried them underneath their homes. But in both places, about 50% of the burials become infants. And there's another view of the temple, and then the palace. The other thing they noticed is that the adult burial, the demographics changed. Obviously, usually men and women are going to make up roughly equal proportions of the population, but in the late stages of this settlement's time period in the 13th dynasty, it shifts to where the female burials are about 60%, a little more than three-fifths of the burials are adult females. We're going to take a look at the Brooklyn Papyrus, which is also called the Ship or Slave List. It has a list of about 95 slaves, at least 70 of whom are probably Asiatics, and they all have names straight from the book of Genesis and Exodus, names like Issachar three times, Menahem is in there a couple times, Shifra famously is on that list, lots of these names, and again, it's about 60% female. And it's the group of slaves on one estate in the middle of Egypt. So the fortunes of this community of Asiatics change. The archaeologist who's been leading the excavations at Avaris, his name's Manfred Biatak. He's an Austrian. And he says at first these people come in and settle, and he calls it like a free zone. And it's amazing the language he uses. He calls them a favored population. He calls it a free zone where they're just kind of allowed to do whatever they want. And then all of a sudden their fortunes change. And if you look at the records of Anku and all that kind of stuff, giving them special treatment, that may have spelled the seeds of their doom. Having a workforce that worked directly for the Pharaoh and only for the Pharaoh also appears in the inscriptions and things like that. That probably spelled the seeds of doom. So when you get to that phrase in Exodus where it says a new Pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph, well, that probably takes place about 100 years after Joseph dies. I find it unlikely that he would not know who Joseph actually was. That may be an expression that he refused to acknowledge Joseph and his family. He's a native Egyptian. It's a native Egyptian dynasty who probably was trying to subjugate Joseph and the Israelites, as the Bible attests. So the fortunes of this population changed drastically. The only question left is, does this fit? Does this chronology fit so far? Well, the archaeological evidence seems to. So we're in the 1600s. Does that make sense? I'll go through something with you really quick here. If you've ever read that Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians in 587, then you have a man named Edmund Thiel to thank for that, because he's the one that started piecing all that together. And then if you've ever heard that Solomon came to power in 971, 970, then you also have him to thank. You go to the year that they began construction on the temple, add 480, and you end up with a year something like 470. So how long then was the sojourn? I'm going to go through a couple things really quick. In Galatians 3:17. Paul says that the 430 years began when the promise was given to Abraham. And that's a little bit different than what we read in the Old Testament, which is most of ours comes from the Masoretic text. So Abraham was given the promise. 430 years after that, the end of the Exodus basically takes place. Here's Josephus antiquities of the, or here's from Qumran. Sorry, here's Qumran. It says, the time that the Israelites spent in Egypt was 430 years. And a lot of people think that the Qumran community was kind of the beginning of the Nazarites. Or not the Nazarites, the Masoretes. But in Josephus, he says, they, the Israelites, left Egypt in the month of Xanthicus, of the 15th day of the lunar month, 430 years after our forefather Abraham came into Canaan, but 215 years only after Jacob entered Egypt. Exodus 12:40 in the Septuagint version. And the sojourning of the children of Israel, that is, which they sojourned in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, was 430 years. Then the Samaritan Pentateuch. Now the sojourning of the children of Israel and of their fathers when they had dwelt in the land of Canaan and in Egypt was 430 years. So what it looks like happened with the Masoretic text is that the phrase "and in the land of Canaan" was dropped, and that's what has come into most of our Bibles. So I'm going to go with it because it seems to have been good enough for the Apostle Paul. He said that the covenant came 430 years after the promise. If you add 215 to 480, you end up right in the time of Amenemhat III, and that's kind of the foundation of all this so far. So it's starting, I think we've at least, can at least say that we have a context, a proper context for all these things taking place. What depends is on what the context tells us after these events. So that takes us roughly down to the time of Moses. Are there any questions before we continue?
It seems to me like a lot of this is important because anytime we look back at the history of Moses, one of the things that has been taken from the gospel and found to the date given to Egypt by Jesus Christ, and then they attached everything on to that.
Right.
Look in the Bible and try to get that to work. This doesn't.
Miles.
Yeah. So what these guys are doing, and I know you've read some of these guys, okay, we'll use the Bible timeline as an anchor.
Right.
And then when you do that, Greek history, Babylonian history, Egypt history, that all lines up.
Right.
So to me, that's what's important in all of this. It's kind of great that you do with the Bible.
Right. Yeah, it's very encouraging to me. It's not something I need for my faith, but to me this is ammunition because I think two of the biggest enemies are the people that believe that the Bible was myth, and there's scholars and academics that perpetuate that, and that's one of the biggest challenges for young people when they go off to college, for instance, is to hear that the Bible's fairy tales and made up. If we can provide a context, and I use that word importantly because, like I said, it's rare for archaeology to actually prove the truth of something. It usually only provides a context. If we can provide a context in which the events of the Old Testament took place, then I think that can bolster people and maybe start to turn arguments. The other would be evolution, but that's not our topic here this morning. So those are excellent points. I appreciate that. Anything else? There's a lot more we could have said about, and we're actually going to circle back around to him here in just a little bit. But this Pharaoh that you're looking at right here is important because, has anyone read Josephus? Bits and pieces. That's the way most people do, is they use it like a reference material. I've actually read through it about 20 years ago, forgotten almost all of it. So don't feel bad. But in Josephus, and of course he had access, according to himself, he had access to ancient records that are no longer available to us. And he says that Moses' stepfather was named Khnophres, which Egyptologists look at that, and it's pretty easy for them. Khnephra. Would you believe that in all of Egyptian history, there is only one pharaoh with the prenomen Khnephra? And we know exactly who he is. And in this time frame that they've reconstructed here, he comes into power about when Moses would have been about the age of 10. His father was a pharaoh in the middle part of Egypt, and then his two older brothers preceded him. And there was a dynasty in the Delta, and this would be the dynasty that Moses came from. And he married the other pharaoh's daughter. And he almost, by doing so, completely reunified Egypt. Remember I had mentioned that the viziers of Anku and his family had kind of divided Egypt, probably to keep the powerful people less powerful than them, kind of hold them down. And then this guy comes close to reunifying Egypt through what's called a dynastic marriage. And his name is given as Kenophres in Josephus. And he was quoting someone that was a couple hundred years before him who was allegedly also using older documents. So if you've read Josephus, you've known the name of his stepfather for a long time. Now in Exodus 1, we're told that they are oppressed and go into slavery. That would have been slightly before this time because we know that Moses was, well, we know Moses' story. And we know that the fortunes of these Asiatics who were living in the Delta and sporadically at least throughout the length of the Nile, their fortunes change. They go from rich to poor. They go from happy to oppressed. They go from princes to slaves in a very, very short time period. Now, just to put this in perspective, according to this chronology, Joseph dies in around the year 1685, and Moses is born around the year 1527. So he's born 50, 55 years after Joseph dies. So the fortunes of these people change. If Rinseneb, and especially if Immeru were Joseph's sons, Immeru reigns for 10 years, about 10 to 20 years after Joseph dies. So you have to consider that as well. So literally, fortunes for these people changed overnight. Now, I didn't give much thought to Josephus' story because it's pretty big concerning Moses until some things have come up in the last 15, 20 years. This is Kuneferaw, and he's one of the best to test. This is ironic because we're talking about Amenemhat III and now Sobekhotep IV. They're two of the best attested pharaohs of this time period. And there's statuary where Sobekhotep has four sons. And the firstborn son, and this is no joke, is Prince Mo. Now, what's a hypocharistikon? Does anybody know? Matt is a hypocharistikon. It's a shortened version of a longer name. So someone named Samuel, we call him Sam. Someone's named Matthew, we call him Matt. Someone's named Ramses, we call him Cece. So, that's a hypocharistikon. The Egyptians used them just like everybody else. You remember King Jeconiah? He was also called Coniah. That's a hypocharistikon. It's just a shortened name of a longer one. So, Kenephres Sobekhotep IV has four sons. The oldest one is Prince Mo. Prince Mo does not follow him on the throne. It only gets better. You remember, in the New Testament, we're told that Moses was learned in what? All the wisdom of the Egyptians. If you're a prince of Egypt, you go through an academy of sorts. It's called the Royal Nursery. At about the age of 15 or 16, you join the army. If you've read history books about the Romans, they had the cursus honorum where a young man would, when he turned about 15, 16, he'd join the army, and then he'd go into law. Of course, we're talking about the elites. But that was essentially what you did as a prince of Egypt. You got to a certain age, and then you joined the army, then you became an architect and oversaw massive building projects. It was all part of your career, and it was set out before you. Prince Mo disappears after a time period. Josephus writes, he gives Moses' adopted mother's name Thermuses. She therefore perceived him to be such a remarkable child, adopted him for her son, having no child of her own. And allegedly, she brings this adopted child to her marriage to Sobekhotep IV. And from there, he continues his journey. And I'm going to read through excerpts of what's said about him. But what made me start thinking there may be something to this is they found evidence of a Cushite invasion during the reign of Sobekhotep IV, and it almost completely overran Egypt. And that's exactly the story that Josephus tells. And because this evidence just came to light within the last decade or so, it kind of kind of blew my mind. It was maybe the last couple of decades, but it still kind of blew my mind. Josephus writes, "Hereupon it was that Thutmosis imposed this name, Moses, upon him from what had happened when he was put into the river, for the Egyptians called water by the name of Mo, and such as are saved out of it by the name Usis, Mo Usis. So by putting these two words together, they imposed this name upon him." So the short name, as we just said, would be Mo, or Mo'u. He continues, "I have brought up a child who is of divine form." This is allegedly Moses' adopted mother speaking. "And of a generous mind, and as I have received him from the bounty of the river in a wonderful manner, I thought proper to adopt him for my son and the heir to thy kingdom." This is allegedly her talking to Sobekhotep IV. So it looks like that this dynastic marriage, part of the agreement was, is that they would unite the two dynasties, but he was supposed to make Moses the heir apparent. But if we've got all this tension, these politics going on between Asiatics and native Egyptians, then you can see where this might have eventually become a problem. So we have this evidence of an invasion from Ethiopia. And Josephus writes, now it is, an historian wrote that it is clear that Cush was a superpower and almost overran Egypt twice. So Josephus writes, "The Ethiopians proceeded as far as Memphis," which is basically about two-thirds way through Egypt, "and the sea itself, while not one of the cities was able to oppose them. Moses came upon the Ethiopians before they expected him, and joining battle with him, he beat them and deprived them of the hopes they had of success against the Egyptians. And he went on in overthrowing their cities, and indeed made a great slaughter of these Ethiopians." Now, he mentions a daughter of the king of Ethiopia. Tharbis was the daughter of the king of the Ethiopians. She happened to see Moses as he led the army near the walls and fought with great courage. You remember that passage where Aaron and Miriam are jealous of Moses? And they're like, you know, you're not the only one that God speaks through and all those things. You remember how that starts? They start chiding him because of his what? His Ethiopian wife. And I've asked people about that before, and the consensus seemed to be that they were confusing Ethiopia with Midian. If you've ever seen a map of the ancient world, Midian's in Arabia, and Ethiopia is south on the eastern shoreline of Africa. The ancients knew the difference between the two places. The other thing is that according to Josephus, Moses was about 30 when this war started, and it lasted about 10 years. He conquers it, says, "She fell deeply in love with him and sent to him the most faithful of all her servants to discourse with him about their marriage. He thereupon accepted the offer on condition that she would procure the delivering up of the city. No sooner was the agreement made than it took effect immediately. And when Moses had cut off the Ethiopians, he gave thanks to God and consummated his marriage and led the Egyptians back to their own land." So he goes back in triumph, and he's about 40 now. He's extremely successful and extremely popular. This is the way you take over kingdoms, is by being successful. Have you ever read that part? I remember reading this as really, I was pretty young, 11 or 12 years old. Moses kills the Egyptian, and then he runs away because they want to kill him. And I remember reading that and saying, who cares? He's the prince of Egypt. He should be able to kill anybody he wants. Well, if we provide a context here where there might be a dynastic struggle between Moses and his, I guess they'd be stepbrothers, then it starts to make a little bit more sense. They're jealous of him. And it starts to kind of sound like the Sadducees and Jesus a little bit. They envy him. He's been successful in this massive campaign that literally saved Egypt after it was about to be overwhelmed. So when I read this story initially from Josephus all those years ago, I put it out of my mind because I was like, well, it's just fancy fairy tales. But it does seem that we have archaeological evidence that it actually did took place. And with what was said about Moses in the New Testament, that he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. He got a royal education. This is what Egyptian pharaohs and princes of this time did, as they fought wars and they built monumental architecture and things like that. So Prince Mio, or Mo, then may indeed be proof that Moses was his son. Any questions or comments on that?
I know you've made it clear that well, so this
Sobekhotep IV. Yeah. There may have been two, actually, that took place, one early and one late. But at least one. The one that took place late would have begun when Moses was about 30 years old. And as we've learned more about Ethiopia, there's been a lot of exciting things about Ethiopia come up. They were no jokes. They were serious. So if you're digging in Avaris over the last 30, 40 years like Manfred Biatak has done, eventually you get to the late 13th dynasty and you get to these, what they call the plague pits. And this takes place right at the tail end of this Asiatic settlement in Avaris in the eastern delta of the Nile, where literally, you remember those nice tidy burials that I showed you, they literally just tossed these bodies and left them where they lay, probably covered them up, I hope. I can't offer you archaeological proof that the plagues of Egypt did take place when the Bible said they did, but I can offer you this. There's something called the Ipuwer Papyrus. I should have it up here soon. Well, we'll go ahead and do some slides, and then we'll go through the Ipuwer Papyrus. After this settlement is suddenly abandoned, after this plague, this is the floor plan of what I'm calling Joseph's Pyramid. This is where they found his statue pieces. So you come in this way, here's what they call a chapel, here's where the statue had originally been. They found what they call a robber's tunnel. And when they went inside, all the grave goods were stripped. It was stripped bare. And that's not unusual. But what they almost always find when they go into an Egyptian tomb is the bones. They find the mummy or the bones if the person wasn't rich enough to get a mummification. This is one of the few burials they find where it was absolutely empty of everything. And of course, what did Joseph make the Israelites promise? That they would remove his bones and take him to the promised land with them. It's so amazing. The context is pretty astounding. But that's not all. Why was the statue in pieces? This is pretty interesting because somebody hated this guy. Because after the town is abandoned, you can see clearly that someone starts taking an axe to his head. They gouge out his eyes and his face, and they break it into rubble. And here's this is what the archaeologist drew. He called it an unusual hairstyle or wig dyed red. You notice that the eyes are gouged out, attempt to split the head, defaced features. So someone blamed this guy for all whatever was going on in Egypt at the time. This community was abandoned overnight. And this is kind of what they've pieced together as far as the route. Like, we think we found Pithom. Sukkoth means what? Anybody remember? Booth. They found this along the Wadi Tumulat. And it's an extension of the Nile. During the inundation, it actually drains into this canal system there. But this was a place that caravans from Asia would come. The Egyptians apparently didn't just let them enter the Nile. So caravans would come through this canal system, and then they would have to come down and hang out here, and this is where they conducted their business. That seems to be the place of Sukkoth, where the Israelites went. And then this is the canal system. Now, you'll remember, when they left, God didn't want them to go by the way of the Philistines, which this represents, because they weren't ready for war, it says. But we found a couple places that are interesting. One is Pi-ha-hiroth, which is what the Bible calls Pi-ha-hiroth, and it means mouth of the canal, and it's probably in reference to this canal system. These other names here are, this one's for sure, but these other names here are guesses based on the topography and Egyptian source records. But one thing about the crossing of the Red Sea that I've always kind of overlooked is the fact that it does mention the sea. And it seems to indicate that the sea was in sight. That they were between Baal Zephon facing Pi-hahiroth and then the sea. Which would probably put them somewhere in this area. which would be a good place for God to come down in a pillar of the cloud and separate them from Pharaoh's army when he decides to chase them later. All right, so Pharaoh leaves and he chases them with his chariots. And a lot of people, a lot of scholars that have looked at this and disagree with this chronology have said, well, they weren't using chariots back then. Well, if our chronology is correct, then we know the name of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And this is a statue of his son. His name was Khonsoamwasset. And it's going to be hard for you to see, so I'll just point it out. This is part of a thing. And he's sitting here with his wife. That's his wife, and this is him. Right here are chariot gloves. If you're riding, holding the reins of a chariot, you wear leather gloves to protect your hands. And Egyptologists don't doubt that. Those are definitely chariot gloves. So they were using chariots, because the conceit is that Avaris was abandoned, and then it was soon taken over by other Asiatics who are going to be eventually called the Hyksos. And Egyptologists used to say that the Hyksos introduced the chariot to Egypt, but here's evidence that that's not actually the case. They may not have been as widespread as they would have been, but they definitely had chariots at this time period. All right. This is a papyrus that's in a Brooklyn Museum. It's in Amsterdam. Sometimes it's called the Epiwer Papyrus, and sometimes it's called Admonitions of an Egyptian Slave. Now, admittedly, the papyrus comes from the New Kingdom period, but Egyptologists agree that it's written in an older version of the language, the Middle Kingdom. And the way they can do that is it's pretty easy for them. If you open a book and you start reading things like, thy horse has dropped thee on thy head, what time period are you probably looking at in English? You're probably looking at about 400 years ago or so. That's how easy it is for them to determine, because languages change over time. So Epiwer is writing this. So like I said, I can't give you archaeological proof of the Exodus and the plagues, but in Exodus 4:9 it says, the Lord said to him, you are to take some water from the Nile and pour it on the ground, and the water you have taken from the river will turn to blood on the dry land. That's Exodus 4:9. Epiwer wrote, behold, Egypt has fallen to the pouring water, and he who poured water on the ground seizes the mighty in misery. In Exodus 7, 20 and 21, it says, and all the water in the Nile turned to blood. The fish in the river died, and the river stank, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. Epiwer says, the river is blood. As you drink of it, you lose your humanity and thirst for water. Exodus 9, 31, the flax and barley were ruined. 9:6, all the livestock of the Egyptians died. Locusts covered the ground to the surface until the land was devastated. In 10:15, 10:15 says the locusts devoured the surface of the ground until the land was devastated, and they devoured whatever was growing in the fields and all the fruit of the trees. That's Exodus, parts of Exodus 9 and 10. Epiwer says, gone is the grain of abundance. Food supplies are running short. The nobles hunger and suffer. Upper Egypt has become a wasteland. Grain is lacking on every side. The storehouse is bare. Women say, oh, that we had something to eat. Exodus 10:7 says, then Pharaoh's servants said to him, let the people go, that they may worship the Lord their God. Do you not yet understand that Egypt is on the brink of ruin? Epiwer says, what can we do about it? All is ruin. Exodus 10:22 says, for 3 days there was thick darkness throughout the land of Egypt. That's Exodus 10:22. Epiwer says, those who had shelter are now in the dark of the storm. The whole of the delta cannot be seen. So this kind of goes on and on. There's actually more to this. But you remember, like, when the hail came down, what was it mingled with? Fire, which is interesting. Epiwer says, there is fire in their hearts. If only he had perceived their nature in the first generation, then he would have smitten the evil, stretched out his arm against it. He would have destroyed their seed and their heritage. So he seems to be talking about a population of people native that are in the land, right? He says, if only he had perceived their nature in the first generation. So this is a people that have been here forever. So then he would have smitten their evil. He would have destroyed their seed and their heritage. That may he may be recalling Amenemhat III, who allowed the Israelites into Egypt in the first place. Exodus 12:29 says, at midnight the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, heir to his throne, to the firstborn of the captive in the dungeon. That's Exodus 12:29. Epaware says, behold, plague sweeps the land. Blood is everywhere with no shortage of the dead. Children are dashed against the walls. The funeral shroud calls out to you before you come near. Woe is me for the grief of this time. He who buries his brother in the ground is everywhere. Wailing is throughout the land, mingled with lamentations. Exodus 12:30, and Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants, and all the Egyptians, and there was great wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without its dead. Numbers 33:3-4 says, they, the Israelites, left Ramses in the first month. It was the 15th day of the first month, the day following Passover, when the Israelites confidently set out under the eyes of all Egypt. The Egyptians were burying those of their own people whom the Lord had struck down. It's pretty remarkable. Exodus 12:35-36. The Israelites did as Moses had told them, and they asked the Egyptians for silver and gold and for clothing. The Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians that they let them have what they asked, so they plundered the Egyptians. Epaware says, the slave takes what he finds. What belongs to the palace has been stripped. Gold, lapis lazuli, silver, and turquoise are strung on the necks of female slaves. See how the poor of the land have become rich, whilst the man of property is a pauper. And it just keeps going on and on like that. You see these remarkable parallels between the two. And he may be writing from some distance. You know, he may not have witnessed these events, although it seems remarkable close to what the Exodus actually describes as far as the plagues of Egypt go. So can I guarantee that he's writing about the plagues of Egypt? No, absolutely not. I can't. I wish I could. But it seems to provide extra circumstantial evidence that we're in the right time period. So this can be dated by the papyri to the New Kingdom, but by the grammar and syntax to the Middle Bronze Age to the 12th, 13th dynasty. So once again, everything keeps adding up to the 12th and 13th dynasty. Let's see what's next on. So when I was going through this with a couple authors, one in particular, but a couple others, and they were kind of starting to point these things out, it seemed kind of obvious. I was like, only a blind man would refuse to see it, because all we're talking about is a context. Is there a context in which the events of Genesis and Exodus can take place? And I think it's obvious to me that there is, so why all the controversy? So after the crossing of the Red Sea, we'll take a kind of a quick trip. They come down, and most of these places can actually kind of be found as they trip, as you go through them. This is the Wadi El Mura, which means the river or brook of bitterness, and it's the same as Mara, which is one of the places they stopped. And explorers have long noted the brackishness of the water there. It's nasty. It's like alkaline. But then they came down to a place called Elim, which today is called the Wells of Musa. Now, what's the description of Elim? Does anybody remember? How many wells? There are 12 wells and 70 palm trees. There's a little more than 70 palm trees, but there's still 12 wells or springs. So that's a pretty good spot for Elim. Then they go down and it says they camp by the Red Sea. And the reason this is a good place to put them is because you're not going to travel along this shoreline. This is not quite sheer coast, but it's pretty, it'd be pretty tough for old people and animals and things like that. The reason I point that out is because there's books and documentaries that are going to come out that have the Israelites going all the way down to the tip, crossing the Red Sea into Arabia, but it doesn't make sense as far as the time frame and some other things. What I found as I've looked into these things, like the Exodus route and whatever, is that the ancient traditions are kind of strong for a reason. So you can stop at this point and you can follow the Wadi El Tayyiba fairly easily for about 33 miles until you get to a place called Sarabit El Kadim, who I think is Dofka. This is what kind of the surrounding area looks like. The Egyptians called it Dua Mofka. Dua Mofka. So what the Hebrews or Israelites did is cut out the middleman and shorten the word. And that's pretty well attested in ancient times and languages. That was pretty common to do. So Dua Mofka, even Egyptologists agree that they're probably talking about Dofka. What was at Dofka? Turquoise and some copper, primarily turquoise, but also copper mining. And this is a place where seasonally, the Egyptians for the Middle Kingdom, and it was reinstated in the New Kingdom, would take their slaves once they had got their crops in or whatever, and they would take them east. There is a context for this. You remember Moses heads west to meet his brother, who is coming out east? I remember reading that as a kid, and I was like, so they just let their slaves wander around in the wilderness if they felt like it? Well, it seems obvious to me that Aaron was probably one of these work crews, and he's probably one of the slaves that worked these mines. So it seems likely, if you go back here, you do have to leave the road a little bit, because you would normally just continue along here, but they turn and go to Dofka. What would be at Dofka or Dofka? Probably more slaves, and especially ones. There's copper slag heaps all over the place where they were smelting the copper. What do you need to build the tabernacle and all the stuff? You need experts in copper smelting and things like that. So he's probably getting some more slaves who were not in Egypt at the time and getting some experts, metal workers as well. There are a lot of, this is the entrance to one of the mines, so it can be pretty dank and dreary. Each year, a stela was put up. That's what these pillars are called. A stela was put up with the name with all the slaves that were working that year and all of their overseers. And when you pile it all together, there's a lot of stela. I mean, there's a couple hundred of them. So for a couple hundred years, this was a place where they would go. It's also at this place where some inscriptions are found. It's called Proto-Sinaitic. It's the oldest alphabet in the world. It's the precursor of Paleo-Hebrew. And this is where it gets kind of interesting. Usually the Hebrews and the Greeks were considered to have ripped off the Phoenician alphabet. But it's getting pretty obvious that what was the Phoenician alphabet was actually developed in Sinai by this group of slaves. Now, the advantage of an alphabet is democratization. If you have to learn Egyptian hieroglyphics, you have to learn hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of signs in order to write the language. So it takes a career. It takes a full education to learn how to do that. An alphabet can be taught to a child, and then he can learn to read in pretty short term. So alphabets are good things, and this Asiatic population of slaves, seems obvious that they developed this alphabet. So at this place is also a temple of Hathor. The Egyptians did nothing that wasn't official, and they did nothing that wasn't religious. So every time they did something, they built a temple to it. In this case, it's to Hathor. And she is kind of a mother goddess figure. This is her on the right. And you can see these horns, and this is a sun disk between the horns. This is another depiction of her, and she's got these curious-looking ears. This is another depiction of her, where she's a cow goddess. There's the horn. There's the sun disk. Here's a statue of her. She's a cow. There's her udder. There's her horns, and there's the sun disk, because she's a cow goddess. She is probably the golden calf. If Moses did indeed stop at Dua Mofka and get a bunch of workers there who knew how to work turquoise, if Aaron was indeed going to work the mines when Moses went west to meet him on the way, and it was his idea to make the golden calf anyway, I think it's pretty clear that Hathor is probably the inspiration for the golden calf in the first place. There is a linguist who thinks that calf is actually a poor translation and it should actually be heifer anyway. But either way, it seems pretty logical that she was probably the inspiration for the golden calf. This is one of the slave inscriptions, and of course you read it left to right, but it's Mayim, Mem, Aleph, Ayin, Mem. We actually don't know what that sign is, but that means water. So someone was getting thirsty. After you leave Dofka, you go through this system of wadis here, and it's 26 miles to get to what the Bible calls Alush, if indeed Alush is the current modern named Wadi Alush. This is when you head southeast from Dofka. This is the kind of terrain you're dealing with. But it seems like a reasonable place for a procession of escaping slaves to go through. And if you follow that, get to this curious bend there, you'll pass by a place called the Wadi Faerun, and the Amalekites, you remember that the Amalekites attack them, but when Moses describes it and he's talking to the Israelites about it, he says, remember when they attacked you once you had passed by. And if you're following that route, you're going to pass by this Wadi, and after they do, the Israelites complain about being thirsty because they're in this dry, barren place, and there's this beautiful oasis that they just have to walk by because it's armed to the teeth with Amalekites. There's another view of the oasis, and there are ancient ruins scattered throughout this. And then they fight a battle, and you remember this is the battle at Rephidim where Moses is on a hill overlooking the battle, and as long as he holds up his arms, the Israelites are victorious. You got this interesting plain here. I kind of like this, actually. You got this interesting plain there where you could have a huge battle. You got this hill. I actually don't know what that shrine is for. It's a Muslim shrine, but they must like this hill too. There's another view of it. You got this kind of neat little hill that's overlooking this wide plain, and it's in the area. So a possible battleground for the Amalekite battle that took place right before they got to Sinai. So there's the possible location of Rephaim. It's basically from there a straight shot to this group of mountain peaks. And it's actually one mountain with several spurs. This is called the Pass of the Wind. And this is Mount Sinai, Mount Rasafsa. And this is technically one mountain with two peaks. Now, this is where St. Catherine's Monastery is. This is the traditional Mount Sinai. Here's the traditional spot for the golden calf. But I'm going to show you why I think Ras Safsa is actually Mount Sinai. It's because this is the Pass of the Wind. You've got quite a ways to go at this point. But that is Ras Safsa. And I basically chose it for dramatic effect. You're walking down and this is the first mountain you see. So you're actually moving slightly up at this point, and this kind of saddleback is the beginning of going down. But Ras Safsa is the first mountain you see. I just thought that would be kind of cool if that was Mount Sinai. Here's the view of the plain from Ras Safsa. You can almost imagine this being like one of the clefts that Moses was in. You'll notice when you look at the mountains, there's lots of vertical clefts in the mountains, and any one of them could have hid that. But this is the plain of Ur-Raha. Here's that pass of the wind that we were talking about, and here's where it starts going downhill. This, I believe, is probably the wide plain. There's no indication of where the boundaries were put to keep the people away from the mountain when they were afraid. But I don't know if I would expect it, but it's an interesting country for sure. This is from the summit of Ras Safsa. Again, you're looking at the plain of Ur-Raha, where I think the Israelites probably camped. Another view, this is from lower on Ras Safsa, and then this is another shot of the plain. Any questions or comments so far? We just kind of shot through that. What's that? Egyptian. It's interesting because Egypt did not consider Sinai a part of Egypt. But they sure made use of it because they had the power and authority to. But they were definitely Egyptian taskmasters, and the slaves were definitely Semites. No, that was Yeah, that was Rephidim. This is where a likely spot for that. There's no way to know for sure. But you just have this really interesting flat plain, and then you have this hill, which is kind of cool. When I was talking about Ras Hasafsa, which is right here, I was thinking that is Mount Sinai. As you're coming through the pass, that's the peak. That's the first mountain peak you see when you're coming.
What's the distance from the mine to
the 30-some miles, I think. Yeah, it'd be about 33, 32 miles. Anything else? Yep.
You may have stated it. The two sons of Thoth, are we thinking that those are in fact driven assets?
It would fit. That would be their Egyptian names. I can't remember what Rinsadeb means. Imeriu means overseer or commander or something like that. But either way, we know that Anku had a daughter who married a pharaoh. And that was apparently late in life, too. Anything else? Sure. Where at? Like the Amalekites? Oh, at the mines? What's difficult? I'm sorry, I'm not catching it. Oh, I see. Okay. I can't prove that they freed slaves while they were there. It just seems like a likely scenario. Because, like I said, you have to turn off the track to get there. And if that is Dofka, then that's exactly what they did. So whatever was there, they went out of their way. And I wouldn't think that they were going there to get more wealth, because they had just plundered the Egyptians and probably had all that they could carry. So I don't know. Not everyone that went with them was perhaps a slave either. Kenites were among them, and they were Midianites, and Midianites weren't necessarily slaves either. Yeah, and in the Bible it does say a mixed multitude went up out with them. I didn't really go through that much. You remember when I showed how the settlements expanded in Goshen, and you have Semites throughout the entire thing? You know, I can't prove how many people were in Jacob's camp. But if you go by Abraham's numbers and kind of Esau's numbers, Abraham had about 400 fighting men. You can usually double that or triple that to get the number of non-fighting men and boys. You double that and you got the number of females. So Abraham's camp, even though he has 300-some warriors, probably has 1,500 plus people in it, maybe 2,000 to 2,500. That's why he was such a big deal. He had a lot of people at his disposal. So when he goes into Canaan, it's like the rulers of the cities are going out of their ways to make covenant with him so that he's not a problem for them. And then he basically has free range anywhere he wants to go in Canaan. And go ahead. All right, I'll finish this real quick. What we know is that not all of these Asiatics were descended from Joseph. And there are scriptural indications that there was a camp of Joseph and a camp of Jacob somewhere in Canaan. And eventually, I think those people probably came down. And that may have swelled Avaris' numbers by 2,000 to 3,000. I don't know how many people Jacob had in his retinue. But there were other Asiatics that came. And this would have been part of the mixed multitude that eventually leaves Exodus. We know there's inscriptional evidence of a chieftain from Syria, one from even farther north than that, around Haran area. They were all coming down to Egypt for what? For the same reason that Jacob was, because there was a major famine. So, did you have something?
One of the things that left me wrong.
Okay.
Why would you get off the path?
Right.
So they got off the path for something. And then, so there is this mining system.
Right.
And the other villages that have their mining names in it.
Right.
So,
right. I can't prove it, so I'm certainly not going to argue about it too much. But I think one of the things that does maybe give pause would be they wouldn't have been able to partake of the Passover. They wouldn't have maybe known about it or anything like that. But then you have to wonder, would God have held them accountable for something that they didn't know about? And again, these may not have actually been descendants of Jacob. They could have been Kenites, Midianites, just someone who understood how to work metal. I hesitate to mention this. There's a scholar named Doug Petrovic, and he's an epigrapher. And last year, about almost exactly a year ago, he thinks he had deciphered some of these early alphabetic writings. Not all of them can be deciphered. And he thinks that at Sarabet El Kadim, or Dafka, he's found inscriptional evidence of Ahizamak. And it calls him Ahizamak, master or overseer of the minerals. Now, who's Ahizamak? It's kind of obscure. Remember Aholiab? Aholiab, the son of Ahizamak. He was one of the artisans that God inspired to help Moses with the crafting of the implements of the tabernacle. Now, it's very controversial. I mean, anytime something confirms the Bible in archaeology, it's extremely controversial. I almost didn't mention it, but Ahizamak. Right. Yeah, the other thing that's, you know, the thing about archaeology is it paints a real world. You know, the Bible, I was going to mention this earlier, you have to remember, the Bible is very good at what it does. It's an accurate history, and it's from a theological point of view. It has a purpose. It's a history that's factual, and it has a purpose. And, you know, skeptics might look at this stuff and say, well, you know, if Exodus really happened, why didn't they name the Pharaoh? Well, you have to keep in mind that the purpose of the book of Exodus is not to tell us who the Pharaoh of the Exodus was. The purpose of the book of Exodus is to tell us who the God of the Exodus was. That's why God gets named and the Pharaoh does not, because the Pharaoh could literally be just anybody. So the Old Testament was written from a theological perspective. That doesn't make it bad history. But things that matter to God don't matter to other people. And when we're looking at this stuff from extra-biblical sources, they're going to put their spin on it. They're going to treat it the way that they would treat it. So they'll ascribe, perhaps, different motives than we would or the Bible would. But that's just what they saw. The other thing to keep in mind is people are usually multifaceted. You know, we're complex. We usually have multiple reasons for doing the things we do. So this was a real world. People are complex. Politics are complex. Invasions are complex. And on we go. Any other questions? All right. Well, after their year down here, it's pretty kind of actually easy to kind of trek their way up. Like you may remember Harada. And there's a place today still called Harada. And what explorers have done is they've just kind of traced the most likely route that a large group of people would take traveling up the eastern side. This is a valley that's north of Sinai, of the mountains, that is. And people think that this, you can kind of see it, this oasis might be Hazeroth. There's a closer view of it, so that's going, I believe north is this way. Likely place for them to stop. Here's possible place for Harada. It's called Arad, and this is the Arad Valley, looking down into it. It's kind of a low-lying canyon, but it's got natural water. Decent place to stop. This is Gebel Asfar, which could be Mount Shefer. And this map I put up here, so here's like Edom and Midian and all that. They're coming up this way. This is the most likely route they would travel. And this is Kadesh Barnea. Well, I'll say it's Tal El Kederet, which people think is Kadesh Barnea. But I'm also going to show you some interesting stuff at this place called Mount Karkom, because there are both possibilities for Kadesh Barnea, for obvious reasons. At Karkom, there's this interesting little feature here where there's 12 rocks lined up for apparently no reason. Standing stones. They're not very tall. They're only about 1.5-2 feet tall. You also find these curious petroglyphs. It's going to be hard for you to see, but there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, which some people say might be the Ten Commandments. Here you might have a menorah, although some people say it's a tree. And some people think this guy is turning a staff into a snake. Those are just called the Karkom petroglyphs. You can look. There's a lot more petroglyphs than that because that area was frequented quite often throughout the centuries. Here's the other possibility for Kadesh Barnea, and it's one I still like. They may have passed by that other place, but this has got a nice green valley. It's well watered, even though the mountains themselves are dry and desolate. It's a good valley. It's a good place to stop and hang out for a while. And then this is Ezion Geber. It's at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. You remember they came down one side and then went back up the other, which would be on the east side of the Jordan. Lovely place. All right. I decided one thing I would do is try to hit people that are mentioned in the Bible. You remember, we're going to glaze over this stuff. Actually, why don't we stop and take another short break? About 10 minutes. I decided that if I could, I would try to give you people that are in the Bible. I did find a mention of Og. You'll remember Og, the king of Bashan. He's mentioned in an execration text. And an execration text is a curse tablet. And it's where a king or someone would write something nasty about someone they hated. And there was a Phoenician king, I think from probably the 800s or 700s, and he basically told one of his enemies that he was going to send Og of the Rapah or Rapha after them. And if you remember, Og is described as one of the Rephaim. So, you know, there's kind of some ambiguity as to what Rephaim and Nephilim and all those types of things are. Anakim, we're going to talk about the Anakim in a little bit. But Og of the Rapha would seem to be Og of Bashan, and that was hundreds of years after he would have died. So he was obviously a mighty man and a famous man. Some people translate that as his sarcophagus was about 13 feet long. But yeah, he was an exceedingly powerful man and evidently well known. If a king in Phoenicia 300 years later is still, or five, more than that, hundreds of years later, still using him to curse people. But how about Balaam, the son of Beor? You remember the story from Numbers, the children of Israel marching up the eastern side, probably nearly along the Jordan River there. Balaam is called for by a king, and he's supposed to curse the Israelites. And right, here's Beth Shan. Of course, Gilbo and all that stuff is here. Right across, you have Jabesh Gilead, which is going to become important in the time of Saul. And here's a tell, or a ruined mound, called Deir Allah. And they uncovered a house, and the house had a plasterish covering, and it had an inscription on the exterior of the house, which is really unusual. I don't think I've ever seen that before, but this is kind of what they found. They found this kind of enclosure area here. Maybe I shouldn't even call it a house because they have it unroofed, but it's just kind of this weird area. And then here they found this inscription, or at least part of it, with fragments down. And twice, once in the fragments and once actually on the wall, it said, Balaam, the son of Beor, a divine seer, is he, and the inscription, you can look it up, the inscription's kind of interesting. He does mention Elohim in it. You may or may not be surprised. He mentions some other pagan stuff in it as well. But I give you Balaam the son of Beor. So another person from the Bible is historically attested outside of the Bible. All right. One thing we talk about the conquest, we usually spend the majority of our time once they've crossed the Jordan. This was looking east, and Jericho, I believe, is right here. Pretty close. Here's the Jordan River. Here's what's called the Plains of Moab. There's Mount Nebo, allegedly Mount Nebo. Pretty good place to get a view. And there's the highlands of Ammon. And over here, you could probably not see it too well, is a huge Middle Bronze II city. And I keep mentioning that because What we're looking for is anything Middle Bronze II. So this is the view east, basically from the heights of the Judean foothills. Now this is called the Disk or the Kikar of the Jordan. And here's Jericho. Here's Tal Nimrin. There's all these ruined mounds over there. And here's Tal El Hamam. The size of the circle gives you an idea of its footprint. So here's Jericho. It's not much bigger than these two. Jericho is about the same size as this one. It's about half the size of this one. And Jericho's about a third of the size of this one. Now we're told that as the Israelites conquered the kingdom of Sihon and Og, they destroyed about 60 cities. And we're looking in the Middle Bronze II period. And right now, Tal El Hamam and Nimrim are getting full excavations, and it's pretty awesome stuff. These other ones have been sounded, the red and the purple ones, which means they've dug into it to kind of see what's there, and they all fit the same. They're the same culture, the same settlement periods are there, and in Middle Bronze II, at the end of Middle Bronze II, they all get destroyed. Now, the archaeologist that's working at Tal El Hamam thinks he's found Sodom. I actually think he's found cities from the kingdom of Sion because he's way too late. It's Middle Bronze II. That's even too late if you go with the standard chronology. But it is still fascinating stuff. This is the settlement pattern. These grayish ones here would be like before Abraham. These black ones, which include all of these, are Middle Bronze II. I don't know if these have been sounded, but all of these fit the same description. They were all destroyed. And the reason that they're so far away is because the southern plain of Jericho gets an indentation like the Nile does. And there's huge areas of this that are basically shut off to people. What do you remember about crossing the Jordan? It was during the flood. It was after the harvest and during the flood season, during the inundation. So everybody that builds cities along the Jordan stays along this outer ring, basically, so they don't get flooded out. Apparently, these cities were built when it was a little bit drier, would be my guess. If you're standing at the lower levels of Mount Nebo, I mean, look how close you are. But here's the upper city of Tal El Hamam. Here's the lower city. It's just got a gigantic footprint. In fact, remember what it says about Hazor when Joshua enters? It was the foremost of those kingdoms, and it had the largest city, and it had the largest cultural footprint. This is even bigger than Hazor was in the Middle Bronze Age. I think it's a pretty good candidate for Sion's kingdom, because when you go up into the highlands, we don't find Middle Bronze II ruins. In fact, there's some places that people say, for instance, where Dibon and other places that are mentioned in Sion's kingdom, that don't have any archaeology until you get to like the Hellenistic times. So the archaeology just doesn't bear out, but Sihon and Og were both seem to have been extremely powerful Amorite chieftains. There's another view of it. Jericho, you could barely see it. And then if you're standing at Bethel and Ai, there'd be right there, but once again, 1 kilometer is the footprint. And that's gigantic for the Middle Bronze Age in this part of the world. This is from above, and the archaeologists have kind of separated. These are dolmen fields, which those are areas of like stone megaliths, probably where kings were buried and stuff, and there's cave shaft tombs. But here's the agricultural land. There was a small village just outside the gate. And then this, once again, is the huge urban footprint. This is a kilometer from one end to the other. This is what an architectural archaeologist thinks it looked like at the end of the Middle Bronze Age, right before it was destroyed. Give you a little bit of a visualization there. There's another one with the upper city and the lower city, showing us the city wall, where they think the palace may have been. But they have found the temple complex, courtyard area, right in the center there of the lower city. And they've also found the gate, which is impressive. That's an artist's reconstruction of the gate. That's gigantic for the time period. They've also noted that it's kind of Indo-European looking. Now, this is, as you dig down, you're looking at two levels. And this is kind of interesting because that's Middle Bronze 2, and the next occupation layer is Iron Age 2. That's almost 500 to 700 years later. So once it gets destroyed, and I think the Israelites destroy it, it stays unoccupied for a long, long time. This is a hard-fired brick that was found in the destruction, the terminal ash layer, they call it. Hard as a rock. This is pottery. And this is trinitite. What's trinitite? It was named after the Trinity site where the atom bomb was tested in the 1940s. Desert glass. Yeah, you have to get really, really hot. Look how similar this pottery is to this trinitite. I mean, you have to have a fire raging very hot to get... These are bones. Was that? Tal el Hammam. Right, I think it's one of the 60 cities of Sihon and Og. They just did a lot of destruction over there, and the Bible kind of glosses over it because it's not really the point. But there's bones throughout the terminal ash layer. The terminal ash layer was about a meter thick, compressed. Has anybody burned wood or anything like that? You know, you can condense a tree to a pretty small pile of ash. To get an ash rubble, an ash layer a meter thick, compressed, you have to destroy a lot of organic material, wood and people. Here's bone scatter, more bone in the terminal ash layer, just dead people everywhere in the city. This guy was crushed by a wall collapsed on him, probably from the fire, and his bones are burnt. So I think, like I said, I think what we're seeing here is evidence of the eastern half of the campaign as they were clearing the lands that would eventually belong to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. All right. Jericho, once they cross over, I can't archaeologically prove that God walled up the water, but they did get over, and Jericho was indeed destroyed exactly as the Bible says it was. I like that image of it because you get the perspective of the Jordan Valley and the highlands of Judea, just the difference in elevation. But here's what Kathleen Kenyon discovered. And the layers are pretty easy to see here, but we're looking at Middle Bronze 2. Everything we're looking for in the conquest has to be Middle Bronze 2. What they found is a revetment wall or a retaining wall, and it held up what's called a glacis, which is a plaster-covered slope. And it was basically to make it hard for enemies to climb up. Then they found this... This is the outer glacis and the inner glacis, and here's like another retaining wall. And here's the Middle Bronze city wall. And when she dug her trench, what she found is that, just as Joshua describes, all these mud bricks had tumbled all the way down, and she found them here in a pile outside the revetment wall, just like the Bible says. The walls tumbled outward. Some of this stuff is so obvious, I don't know why archaeologists can't see this. But how long did the siege last? 7 days. It took place just after harvest. So you would expect to find vessels full of grain, and in this case, burnt grain. And in every single house they excavated, they've excavated quite a few by now, they find pots full to the brim with burnt grain. Look how, you can even tell in this black and white photo, how black that is. Burnt grain. Just like the Bible says. This is an artist's reconstruction of the houses that were built up against the outer wall. When Garstang excavated earlier in the century, he was lucky enough to find the portion of the northern section of the wall that did not tumble. And this is kind of an artist's representation of that. There was one section of the wall, you can see all the destruction, that did not collapse. And he was kind enough to put Rahab's red ribbon out there for us to give us an idea. But it was the only portion of the city's outer wall that didn't collapse, just like the Bible said. So it's pretty remarkable. I'll introduce you to this guy now. This project, I guess you could call it, started about 20 years ago when I first started college. And I've read everything I could get my hands on. And I've been beating my head trying to put square pegs into round holes for a long time. And a couple years ago, I was just kind of playing with things for fun because I'd read an article in the UK Daily Mail. There's an article by their archaeological correspondent, and he said he was running through a list of recent archaeological finds, and he said the Bible, it seems, is back in business. And so I read the article, and I read some of the authors he mentioned, and this was one of them, and I had never heard of him before. He's been writing books for 20-some years, and his name's David Roll. And I think by the time I got a hold of him, he had already written 4 books. And so I bought one to see if I liked it. I read it in like 4 days. Then I bought the rest of the books he had, and I read those in about a month. And then he came out with his 5th book just about a year ago. But this is one thing he said in a recent documentary. And what this speaks to me, is context again. Is there a context for all these things happening? If we're finding Asiatics that left Egypt overnight with bodies tossed in pits haphazardly, and then not long after that there's a slew of destructions in Canaan and in the Transjordan, then that has to be the Exodus and the conquest. And I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think if we look at that map, of these cities here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, that's 11 right there that all have destruction layers dated to the same time period. These I'm not sure about, but I would not be surprised if these also bit the dust at the same time. That would add 1, 2, 3, 4, another 4. So that might be 16 right there of the 60 cities that the Israelites destroyed. When you hop over the Jordan, there have been 55 cities from the Middle Bronze Age II period that were either destroyed or abandoned. And in the next couple hundred years, only 22 of them were reestablished. That has to be the conquest. Also, keep in mind, there were only, I think, 3 cities that were actually put to the full ban. And that was, I believe, Ai, Hazor, and one other. Was it Jericho? I can't remember, but people will look at Lachish, and they'll say, well, it says that he killed all the people. Why isn't it destroyed? Because Lachish doesn't have a middle bronze to destruction layer. Well, if you read the text, don't read too much into it. It says he killed all the inhabitants. It doesn't say he destroyed the city. So the Bible means exactly what it says. If it says Lachish was not destroyed, then Lachish was not destroyed. But that's pretty remarkable. 54 or 55 confirmed destructions or abandonments in the Middle Bronze II period, and only 22 of them are rebuilt or reoccupied over the next couple hundred years. Jericho is so obvious it almost hurts when scholars talk about it these days. Context is everything. Real quick, one of the tombs that Kathleen Kenyon excavated, this is a reconstruction of it, it's called Warrior Tomb, is one of the last burials that took place before the terminal destruction layer. In it, they found an interesting scarab. Does anybody remember the name of the chieftains of the Anakim at this time? I'll give you the first clue. It's Talmai, Ahiman, and the third, well, he's actually mentioned second, is Sheshai. And wouldn't you know it, in Deuteronomy, you'll remember Moses has given his last pep talk to him. And this is 40 years after the Exodus. And he says that Egypt is ruined even to this day. So whatever the Exodus and the plagues did to Egypt, Egypt still hasn't recovered from it. After Avaris and the eastern delta are abandoned, a new group of Semites just literally waltzes right in. I want to read you something from Manetho. He was a Hellenized Greek, or a Hellenized Egyptian priest from the Ptolemies. And after the Septuagint was translated, it started like the first antiquities race because people published, the Old Testament was published in Greek and it started being read and people were like, wow, the Jews have a really long and impressive history. So now everybody wanted to get theirs published, and Manetho was the one who did it for the Egyptians. And he wrote that Tutmosis, in his reign, for what cause I know not, God smote us. He's quoting from an ancient Egyptian source. God, singular, smote us. And unexpectedly, from the regions of the east, invaders of obscure race. So he's giving cause and effect here. The invaders came in because God smote us. Without striking, the invaders' obscure race marched in confidence of victory against our land. By main force, they easily seized it without striking a blow. And that's what we have at Avaris, is literally people just walk, a new Asiatic people just walking in and taking over. Having overpowered the rulers of the land, they then burned our cities ruthlessly and treated all the natives with a cruel hostility, massacring some and leading into slavery the wives and children of the others. The Anakim were the leaders of obscure race. We can tell by their names that they're Indo-European. They're probably from the north, from the Mitanni. But Sheshai, who is mentioned in the Bible, has a scarab found in the destruction layer of Jericho, bearing his name. And the Anakim are described as having three chieftains. They appear in Egyptian context a couple hundred years earlier, and they have three chieftains. They have different names, obviously, but they have three chieftains, and they are called the Ai Anak, or the Anakim. So here we have another people attested in the Bible. I think it's pretty obvious that Sheshai and Sheshi are the same person. Manetho continues, finally they appointed as king one of their number whose name was Salatus. He had a seat in Memphis, levying tribute from upper and lower Egypt. In the Saite Nome here, the region of Seth was worshipped. He founded a city very favorably situated east of the Bubastite branch of the Nile and called Avaris. So once again, Avaris becomes their capital. And they ally with the Cushites. And they begin to severely oppress the 16th dynasty, which is the last surviving dynasty of Egypt until the Hyksos period ends. This is the dynasty that's going to eventually become the 18th dynasty with Thutmose the Great and all that. There's this question mark here, the Abydos dynasty. That actually seems to have been confirmed. There was just a pharaoh previously unknown that was just uncovered. And he seems to be one of those Abydos. But you can see that map there, the Egyptians have about had it. And that's a description that Moses would give if he was to say, Egypt is in ruins even to this day. And what you'll notice here is that Egypt is in no position to go after the children of Israel. And they're going to be busy with this for the next couple hundred years, about 150, 200 years. Last thing before we leave Jericho for good is you have the terminal destruction layer at Middle Bronze 2, and then there's nothing for like 100 years. And then someone comes along and builds what they call the middle house. And it's this, I wouldn't call it too big. But you remember when Eglon is oppressing the Israelites, he's doing it from the city of Palms or Jericho. And this is the only building. Of course, this is where Ehud goes to slay him. What you have to imagine is that he comes in with the Moabites and builds this house for himself. And then he's surrounded by a tent army. And they go off and raid the surrounding lands, and he waits for them to collect tribute. And that's probably when Ehud made his move. But that building actually remains for a long, long time. And you'll remember when David's ambassadors came back and they had been shaved, he tells them to go to the city of Palm and wait till their hair grows back and all that. There was a building there for them to have waited that out. And then, a couple hundred years after that, they have an Iron Age city built, and it's very small, but that would be the one probably that was built by Hiel, the one that he lost his oldest and youngest sons for. All right, Ai. Does anybody know what Ai or AI means? It means the ruin. I always thought that was a funny name for a city. My assumption had always been that whatever name it went by had been lost, and everybody forgot what it was called, so they just started calling it the Ruin. And that's still my assumption, but we kind of know where Bethel is, and it's always been thought that I was guarding the road to Bethel from Jericho. And there's been a couple possibilities in and around here, and I think found a good one in what's called Kirbet El Makatir. And the reason for that is that it's actually a somewhat substantial fort. You remember the Israelites thought they could take it with 3,000 men, and then they utterly failed. This is what it looks like from the air. And it's a perfect circle, which is actually easy to defend. It's one of the most defensible, and it's guarding a good road on the road to Bethel. It's a logical place for them to have used. What archaeologists believe is that the big towns were like a metropolis, and then they would have been ringed by smaller towns that were under them to some extent. Kind of like what you see with the Philistines and Hazor and things like that. And Ai, they believe, was probably a subsidiary of Bethel. They had the same cultural profile at this time anyway. And there's the current excavations going on there now. There is a destruction layer in the Middle Bronze too. And the main excavator, his name's Bryant Wood, and he's an evangelical guy. And he's one of those guys that's been trying to force the archaeology to fit under the previous chronological scheme. And he's trying to get people to agree with him that he's found late bronze pottery there, but everything I've read, most archaeologists say it was destroyed in Middle Bronze II. So once again, at the end of Middle Bronze II, we have a good city that could be Ai. All right, Hazor, with the foremost of those kingdoms. Of course, as you dig down, Hazor has been destroyed a couple times. But what we're interested in is the Middle Bronze Age, which is actually down here. This is Iron Age until you get over to here. This is the Middle Bronze Age palace. It was actually in use for quite some time, which is unusual. But Hazor was a powerful city, so maybe not. But in the Middle Bronze II destruction area, they found this cuneiform tablet, and it's a letter to Ibni, or Yibni. And you have to remember that there were no consonants in Hebrew, so they would just find like YBN, and they would call him Yabin. But in Akkadian, they call him Ibni. But our etymologists agree, or linguists agree, that we're talking about Jabin. And once again, that's in the Middle Bronze II destruction layer. Although that name would be used by other kings of Hazor. So it may have been kind of a dynastic name as well. Shiloh is kind of an interesting site. I'd never looked into it too much. But it's an interesting hill. Here's the summit. And then you have this kind of plateau area. And that's what an archaeologist kind of would reconstruct it as. You have the main part of the city and then this enclosed sacred compound. This is one of those things where I look at it and I don't understand why archaeologists can't put two and two together. But there, on this plateau is this level area. And we know that the tabernacle was in use at Shiloh for a long time. There's storage rooms for storing gifts and offerings and things like that. And it just keeps getting more and more obvious. They built a rubble platform to level out the area. You can see the wall that was holding it up and the storage cellars. That someone went ahead and diagrammed for us what the area may have looked like. The tabernacle would have been here, laver here, altar here. It's got the right dimensions to be there. The ark would have sat back here, showbread and incense. It's pretty obvious we're talking about the place where the tabernacle actually sat during the judges and into the king's era. But archaeologists, they don't see it. It doesn't fit their timeline. Shechem is kind of cool. Of course, Mount Gerizim is where Samaria would be built, but what happened on these mountains? Yeah, remember they reaffirmed the covenant there and the people were split in half, one on each mountain. And Shechem is right in between them. And someone's tested this and said it forms like a natural amphitheater. But yeah, the blessings and curses of the of the covenant were shouted back and forth. They reaffirmed their commitment to the covenant. Now, Shechem is interesting because it's called different things at different times. Sometimes we hear Migdal Shechem. Sometimes we hear Baal Berith, which means Lord of the Covenant. And in Middle Bronze 2 Shechem, we have this Millo. Remember, that's also used of Shechem after that. Millo means the filled-in area. It means they built a terrace more than anything else. We'll also talk about this little square area there. What happened there in Middle Bronze 2? Well, we have this kind of temple area. And we have this raised area. And this is the Middle Bronze Age wall. Here's the Middle Bronze gate. So this area was the first place you went when you entered. And it was built right at the end of the Middle Bronze Age. And if you look right here, what is that? This is kind of an interesting story. An archaeologist went there to Shechem in the early 1900s. And he was sending back these reports, and he was like, you know, I think I found Joshua's standing stone. You know, the one that he set up in front of Baal Berith. And whoever was paying him, the university or whatever, they got sick of hearing that, so they pulled him off the project and sent an agnostic or an atheist, someone who wasn't very friendly to the Bible. And he was so tired of hearing about this Joshua standing stone stuff that he uprooted it and threw it down a valley, and that's why it's broke. That's pretty kind of obvious. Stories like that kind of illustrate just how much people hate the Bible and how much they don't want God to exist. But he had such problems that they sent an American team back over. They found what they could of it, which was the base, and they reset, they put it back in place. I think the guy that hated it was a European. And when they reconstruct it, this is kind of what they see. Here's that gate that you would walk in. And here, you remember that temple in Avaris? It's basically the same design, but you can see why it would be called both Migdal, which means tower, and why it would also be called Baal Berith. Baal Berith means Lord of the Covenant, and the people would return to renew the covenant. There's Joshua's standing stone. Seems pretty obvious. About 150 years later, it gets burnt down. Who was that caused by? Abimelech. Remember Abimelech, who wanted to be king? The people were afraid of him, so they ran to the tower, and he had his men grab all the wood they could from the surrounding hills, and they set it around and burnt them alive inside. And it was indeed burnt down about 150 years or so after it was built. And that would probably be Abimelech. All right, so we're getting to the period of the judges. This is a Philistine Megaron. And the more we learn about the Philistines, the more it's obvious that they came from the Aegean. They'll even be Mycenaeans. In this new chronological scheme, this is actually, once you get to the time of the judges and the early kingdom, you're actually in the heyday of the Mycenaeans. So this is the age of, you know, Iliad and all that kind of stuff. But they built everything like the Aegeans did. They used cyclopic architecture, which means they just stacked up big rocks. They didn't build things the way the Easterners did. And their megarons had these pillars that held up the roofs of their buildings, whether it was a temple or a palace. And the pillars are really close together. I mean, it's remarkable that people think the story of Samson can be fake, written 500, 600, 700 years after, when they would have no idea how people built temples and houses that then, because most of these places would get destroyed or rebuilt. Even if a city didn't get destroyed, they would periodically have to tear down buildings that became decrepit and just rebuild them, so we would have no idea. But I don't see how they would be able to fake that kind of knowledge there, that Samson was able to do that. Before we get into the kings, any questions or comments? Yes. Yeah.
And the pillars are about 6 feet apart. That has to tell us something about the size of the man.
Right.
Yeah. You've got to feel the
bend of his arm. Yeah. Yeah, I think I heard it described as typically 2 meters. And I think 2 meters is right at, or maybe it was a little less than that, but it was What was that? Yeah, maybe it was a little less than 2 meters, but that was kind of typical. Yeah, it does give you an idea of how big he must have been. No matter what time period they're digging in, from the early Bronze Age to the Roman times, the people of this area, the men, were typically about 5 feet 3 inches tall. That seems to have been the average. So they weren't as big as us, and it's probably because they didn't eat the same kind of diet. They may have been more robust, like constitution and overall health-wise, but they weren't as big as we were. So someone, even in his day, if he was, you know, 6 feet plus, and he would have been considered a giant for sure. Anything else? All right. Well, with the balance of our time, we're going to spend some time in the kingdom era. And once you get, and you know, we kind of dealt with Solomon. We probably won't get all the way to Solomon. But once you get past Solomon, we're pretty well into documented history. For instance, you remember Misha, the Ammonite. He wrote something called the Moabite Stone or the Misha Stele. He mentions Omri. He mentions the House of David. And we know that he was instrumental in dismantling Israelite power east of the Jordan River. In fact, his Stele that he wrote is the longest inscription that we have from Canaan or the Transjordan during that time period. So it's pretty interesting reading. But he's another figure, once again, that the Bible describes in really accurate detail. And then you go a little bit further, you get to guys like Jehoram and Ahab. And, Ahab is around that time period. Hezekiah, Ahaz, all those guys start being fairly well attested in sources other than the Bible, and the chronologies start linking up back again to where once we get to the time of Hezekiah and a little bit after that, it's pretty easy to open a book and you'll find archaeological evidence and historical evidence and things for that time period. So we'll probably spend the rest of our time in the time period of Saul and David. And as we introduce this, we haven't spent much time in the Bible. I've kind of trusted you guys to know your Bible a little bit. What was Solomon's other name? My wife almost got this one this morning. Jedediah. Does anybody know what Jedediah means? It means the beloved of Yahweh, or the friend of God. But that middle part, what we have is D-I-D, or sometimes it's D-A-D or D-E-D, the did or the dud, is the part that's beloved. Now, what does David's name mean? It means beloved. So when he presents Solomon to Nathan and says his name, it's kind of ambiguous, actually, who's calling him Jedediah. Is it David or is it Nathan? But it does include David's name in it, and it's Duud. We don't actually know. It's the same name when you're reading in the appendices of 2 Samuel, and it mentions Dodo of Bethlehem. That's actually also the same name. It's just we don't know how the Hebrews pronounced it at that time. But throughout the Old Testament, we see it time and time again. When someone achieves a new status or a greater status or something like that, they oftentimes get a new name. Abram became Abraham. Jacob became Israel. Joseph became Zaphnath-Paneah or Zetanath-Paneah. Solomon had at least two names, and it's hard to say exactly which was actually the first one. Jedediah may have actually been the name he grew up with, and then Solomon was added when it was obvious that his reign was going to be peaceful. So we see this time and time again throughout the Bible. And in fact, David, it seems, may have had an original name other than David. And so we get to the first king of Israel, and his name is Saul. And what does that mean? You remember? Shaul. It means asked for. Well, it's unlikely that his parents named him asked for, because it seems that what happened is it kind of became a name that was attached to him because the people did what? they asked for a king. So he became known as the one who was asked for. And in fact, Shaul, we talked about hypercharisticons, it may have had something else attached to it. We don't know. But scholars have long looked at the Amarna letters and noticed some striking similarities between the Amarna letters and, as I talk, these are interesting high place of Gibeon and things like that. This is where Samuel would have had his meal with Saul at his choosing, I guess. Remember when it mentioned the pillars of Gibeah that Jonathan knocked over? Some people translate that governor, but pillar seems to be a better indication. Those are footings for pillars. Remember, they didn't have flags back then, so when a king or an empire conquered something, they would actually set up a pillar and say, "This is mine." And Jonathan went over and knocked over the pillars at Gibeah. And then you remember Michmash. I was looking at that, and it says that the Philistines were encamped there. I was like, well, if Michmash is a city, why would it say they were encamped there? Well, this is all there is to Michmash. It's just like a little, there's no city wall, there's no nothing. There's just this kind of barracks-looking thing, but you would have camped around it. Of course, Jonathan has an interesting encounter with the Philistines there. We'll take a little bit of a look up. That's a close-up of it, but that's all there is to it. People have often looked at the Amarna letters and said, wow, that is so close to the early monarchy of Israel. But the problem is, according to the standard chronology, the Amarna era is 300 years too early. And so it can't possibly be the Israelites. But it's also too late to be the conquest. So we have this interesting conundrum here where, according to the Bible, you have the conquest, and then about 400 years later, you have Saul and David. According to the standard chronology, right in the middle of that, you have the Amarna age, which, you know, there's Bible-believing Egyptologists and scholars that are trying to make that fit the Judges period, but it doesn't quite work. In Egypt, the Amarna age takes place in the late Bronze, and it's at the end of one of the actual great periods of the 18th dynasty. You remember me talking about the Anakim and the Hyksos. Well, the 18th dynasty comes up and kicks those people out and basically almost annihilates them. And then they reestablish a united Egypt and a very strong one. Thutmose III is generally regarded as maybe the second most powerful pharaoh of all time, and he's called the Napoleon of Egypt. And his son and grandson are pretty good pharaohs too. But then, in the Amarna age, at the end of the late dynasty, Akhenaten takes over, and he initiates a religious reform and completely allows the Egyptian empire that Thutmose built to kind of start falling apart. Eventually, his son Tutankhamun left Amarna and just literally let it fall to pieces. And in one of the parts of the Amarna palace, they found something called the House of Pharaoh's Correspondence, and they found these tablets, about over 300 of them. They're all written in Akkadian, which was the lingua franca of the day. And it's correspondence between Pharaoh and Canaanite kings and Assyrian kings and Babylonian kings. So just about any king you can imagine was writing to Pharaoh at this time. And I think about three-fourths of them are actually dealing with or from Canaan and Phoenicia and the Transjordan area. I might save that for just a minute here. And in it, we learned that there's someone causing a lot of problems for the Canaanites. And what we learn is that all of the Canaanites, the Philistines, the king of Hazor, all of them were vassals of the Pharaoh. And they're sending them these letters about these Habiru, who are causing them all kinds of problems, and one Habiru in particular. Now, scholars have looked at this word and agonized on it for a long time because it's so similar to Hebrew. And they say, wow, everything fits so closely except, you know, it's not quite right because Habiru, it's very similar to Hebrew if you take out the vowels. Now, here's what we know about the Hebrews. They tended to be rebels, they tended to be nomads, and they tended to be warriors. And they tended to not get along with Egypt and the Canaanites. They were not settled folk. If you look at the Old Testament, do the Israelites ever refer to themselves as Hebrews? The first person descended from Jacob that I can think of that refers to themselves as a Hebrew is actually Paul in the book of Philippians. Before that, it's always used by outsiders for the Hebrews. And the first time that Abraham is called a Hebrew is when he enters Canaan. And just like I had mentioned earlier, what does he do when he enters Canaan? He lives a nomadic lifestyle. He makes military alliances with the settled chieftain, with the settled kings of the cities. And that's kind of what they associate the Hebrew with throughout the rest of time. Until you get to this time, and it's actually used as a pejorative. They use it for not only mercenary and nomad, but also kind of worthless men and rebels and scum like that. We're probably pretty familiar with the story of Saul and David, but I want to go to 1 Samuel 13. Saul has saved Jabesh-Gilead, and he's been crowned and all this stuff. And in 13, he has the unlawful sacrifice where God finally rejects him. And that appears to have taken place, that actually seems to have happened very quickly into his reign, that God rejected him. And in verse 16 it says, Saul, Jonathan, his son, and the people present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped in Michmash, that little square area, and that's where they encamped. The raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned onto the road to Ophrah, to the land of Sheol. And verse 19 says, now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. This fits very well with archaeology, where we know that the people inhabiting the Judean highlands and the Transjordan were much much poorer than the surrounding Canaanite communities around them. And that may add a little context to why the people wanted a king, because one of the things we learn is that the kings controlled international trade. They didn't have, you know, merchants, and not the way we think of them anyway. Kings controlled international trade. If you wanted to participate in international trade, you had to be a king. You had to have a unified culture. You had to have a country. And what do we see? They ask for a king. They get Saul and then David, who are warriors, and they have to unify the people. But then the beneficiary of that ends up being Solomon, who is styled as a merchant prince in the Bible, and he benefits from the trade relationships that really his dad, David, worked. And to a great extent, Saul as well worked to accumulate. So we have these poor people, they're rebels, and they don't have much stuff. They're jealous of the people around them. And in 14, we have this kind of interesting scenario. Now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he did not tell his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod, but the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side, and the name of one was Bezez, and the name of the other Sina. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other southward opposite Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of this uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work with us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. Now, what would you assume? Well, I'll just point this out. One thing that archaeologists have surmised from the evidence is that after the end of the Middle Bronze Age II, remember I talked about all those cities being destroyed, not reoccupied? that after that, for several hundred years, there was a small urban elite that settled. So basically, when you're reading the Old Testament, the Judges and 1 Samuel, if your name is attached to a town, or if you own something like a threshing floor, you're one of the elite. You're one of the richer, wealthier people. And we see that in the story of Ruth. Boaz has fields. Not everybody had fields. For the most part, at least half of the population, maybe more, still lived a nomadic lifestyle. And that persisted for a long time. In Saul's lifetime, it'll mention them returning to their tents. Even a couple hundred years later, in the time of Jehoaz, I think that's around 1 Kings chapter 13, it mentions the people returning to their tents. So that nomadic lifestyle still persisted for some time. Here we have Jonathan and Saul, and they are of Gibeah. So their names are attached to a town. They're one of the wealthier elites. When Saul goes out looking for his donkey, his father's donkeys, who does he take with him? Father says, take servants. So they have servants or slaves. Jonathan has armor. People that were rich, only the rich and the elite could afford armor. So there's all these kind of interesting archaeological pieces that we can pick up that confirm this story over and over again. So then, continuing in 1 Samuel 14. So his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart. Go then, here I am with you according to your heart." Then Jonathan said, "Very well, let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, 'Wait until we come to you,' then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, 'Come up to us,' then we will go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us." So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, and here's where it gets interesting, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden." You remember what happened after the Israelites were defeated? The people ran to the caves. So he says, "Look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden." Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan, his armor bearer, and said, "Come up to us and we will show you something." Some translations say, "We'll teach you a lesson." Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel." And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after them, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. And there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. It keeps getting more interesting. So Saul calls to the people, "Now call the roll and see who has gone from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here," for at that time the ark of God was with the children of Israel. Now it happened while Saul talked to the priest that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." And Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle, and indeed every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews, who were with the Philistines before that time, went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country. They also joined the Israelites, who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim. When they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in the battle. Did you notice anything odd? Right. I always thought the Hebrews were Israelites and vice versa, but in this passage, it is making a distinction between the Hebrews and the Israelites. When Jonathan appears, he says, the Philistines look at him and say, "Oh, look, the Hebrews are coming out of their holes," and yet it appears that the Philistines do have Hebrews who fight for them. And when you read the Amarna letters and you look at the evidence throughout 1 Samuel, there does seem to be a distinction that the Hebrews are fighters. At least they are in 1 Samuel. That's what they do. They have a lifestyle very similar to what we see David pursuing when he's with Achish, which is something of a vassalage type mercenary. We see it when Jephthah, he had a similar lifestyle where Jephthah didn't have fields of his own, so what he did was protect other men's fields. So what we have are worthless men. You remember that description of David's men as being worthless? Now, I always kind of thought that meant scallywag, but it seems that what that actually means is they were landless, or they didn't have property of their own, and so they were hooking up with David, who was a great warrior, and trying to have success with him. And the way, and this is what scholars have always noted, and this is another one of those things why they can't, I can't see why they can't put two and two together. They look at the way the word Hebrews is used in the book of 1 Samuel. And they look at the way the word Habiru is used in the Amarna letters. And they say, wow, it's amazing how similar it is. But then they can't put two and two together and see that, yes, the two are the same, indeed. Because what's more important than where a word may originate from, it's how it's used within its own period and its own context. So if you read, like, what's the origin of the word Hebrew, they're probably going to go back to Abraham's, would be his grandfather, Eber, or great-grandfather. But they'll say that Hebrew probably comes from Eber. And there's, you know, that seems decent enough explanation. But that doesn't mean that the word Hebrew is going to stay the word Hebrew. For look how quickly words change definition and meaning in our culture. So we have a word Hebrew in the Habiru in the Amarna letters that seem to reflect the usage of the word Hebrew in 1 Samuel. Any questions or comments so far? Right. Yeah, that's what one scholar pointed out, is that Hebrews was probably an umbrella term, and so is apparently Philistine. And the Israelites would have fit under that. And that may have been the original distinction, but at this time period, it seems that the Hebrew were soldiers as much as anything else. Because every time they're mentioned, whether in this context or in the Amarna letters, they're soldiers. And sometimes they're called rebels. In a previous chapter, Saul has just been anointed king. And it says something interesting that I had never really paid attention to before. There were not everybody was so trusting, I guess, or thought as much of him. So at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 24, and Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? And there is no one like him among all the people." So all the people shouted and said, "Long live the king." Then Samuel explained to the people the behavior of royalty and wrote it in a book and laid it up before the Lord. And Samuel sent all the people away, every man to his house. So he sent every man to his house. So who's he talking to? An archaeologist would tell you that these are the elite people. These are the richer people because they have homes. They have houses. And verse 26, and Saul also went home to Gibeah, and valiant men went with him. So this is the beginning of his army, whose hearts God had touched. But some rebels said, "How can this man save us?" So they despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his peace. Now, there's one way to look at it is they're rebels because they didn't want to follow Saul. But the more likely understanding there is that they're rebels because they're rebelling against the Philistines. And what we know from the Amarna letters is that the Egyptians used the Philistines like a police force. And we see that in the book, near the end of the book of Judges, they start oppressing the people of Israel. It's because apparently the Egyptians had decided that they did not want Israel, the Israelites, to become too powerful and threaten what was making Egypt so rich, which was all the trade that flowed along the coast of the Mediterranean. Okay. So, back to these Amarna letters. Now, they're all numbered, but they're numbered by the way they were picked up. They were just basically scattered, so they're 1 through 315 or something like that. What scholars have had to do is read them, translate them first, and then try to put the story back together. And when the scholars who were putting this chronology that we're using started noticing some interesting correspondences here. And it gets to the point where you can literally read the Amarna letters in one hand and 1 Samuel in the other, and you get a pretty interesting story. So, Amarna, EA, it's called EA for El Amarna, 252 says, "It was in war that the town was seized. After I had sworn my oath to keep the peace, and when I swore, the governor swore with me," and he's implying here he swore with the Egyptian governor, "the town, along with my God, was seized. And now I am slaughtered before the king, my lord. Moreover, if an ant is struck, does it not fight back and bite the hand of the man that struck it?" Does that sound like a proverb? "How could I hold back this day when 2 of my towns had been seized? I will keep imprisoned the men who seized the town and my God. They are the despoilers of my father, and so I will keep them as hostages." This could be, if this man that's writing this letter to Pharaoh is Saul, that the town that was seized was Gibeah, and the towns that he took back then were Gibeah and Michmash, and that's what he's talking about when he says they were mine to begin with. If an ant is struck, does it not bite the hand that struck it? And it begins a series of letters from someone that I believe it was William Albright, who was a major biblical archaeologist. When he was looking through the Amarna letters, he described this Canaanite king, or this king from central Canaan, who was writing Pharaoh, as rustic, untutored, and unskilled in diplomacy. He was new to it. And isn't that exactly the way Saul kind of describes himself when he says that I'm from the least of the tribes of and the least of the clans of the tribes of Israel? So we have this guy who didn't grow up to be king, but this may indeed be Saul. In letter 289, we know his name. The Jebusite ruler of Jerusalem writes to Pharaoh and says, "Are we to act like Lebiah did when he gave the land of Shechem to the Habiru?" So the land surrounding Shechem was conquered by Lebiah, and he gave it to the Habiru. Now, Lebiah is his name in the letters, and it's written in Akkadian, so it might be slightly different than what it is. But one thing that they noted is that even though Lebiah writes in Akkadian, the alphabet that they use, he's actually speaking in Canaanite, probably because he doesn't know actual Akkadian. But this could very well be, and we'll read some more, the birth name or the original name of Saul, which seems to be kind of a traditional name or a name that was applied to him after he became king. Now, what does Lebiah mean? It means great lion or mighty lion. Some have looked at it and said, well, it actually might mean lion of Yah or lion of Jehovah. But the reason I like it is because in plural, it would be Lebiyim. And so if you turn to Psalm 57, Psalm 57 was written by David when he was fleeing from Saul. And it may be less metaphorical than I had given it credit for. "Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you, and in the shadows of your wings I will make my refuge. Until these calamities have passed by, I will cry out to God Most High, to God who performs all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me. He reproaches the one who would swallow me up, Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. My soul is among lions. I lie among the sons of men who set on fire, whose teeth are spears and arrows, and are and their tongue a sharp sword." Now there are other translations, because this is kind of a interesting use of the word lions. It can be translated as mighty lions or great lions, and a plural of that would be Labayim. And here David says he's surrounded. My soul is among lions, or I am surrounded by lions. So he's on the run. But these lions are unique because they set things on fire. And they have teeth that are spears and arrows and sharp swords. What he's describing are soldiers. Now, here's the thing. We just saw that Saul was creating his professional soldiers, his valiant men. And if you've been a part of an army unit or a military unit, one thing that really helps establish esprit de corps is a unit name. It gives a starts it's the building of a tradition. And if your name is Labaya, then there's no better name for your elite warriors than the mighty lions. So this may not be as metaphorical as may appear. It may be literally. When David says, my soul is among the lions, or I am surrounded by the mighty lions, he's actually talking about Saul's personal bodyguard, his elite soldiers. So there is some scriptural evidence that may attest to the fact that this is indeed, that Labaya is Saul. And there's a lot of things as you go through this. If you take the Bible and you take the Amarna letters and you learn the towns and the parts of Canaan that Labaya is in charge of, it's the exact same towns. It's the exact same parts of the highlands. And he's trying to move into the lowlands and into the coasts. And that's the thing that the Egyptians and the Canaanites don't want. Jerusalem is starting to be surrounded. And we see that eventually that David's going to complete the conquest of the Jebusites. So everything fits. The political, the social, the military, the technological, anything you want to look at a culture, it all fits this time period. So, going on, we learn in 1 Samuel 17, describing the Philistines as wielding weapons of iron. Any culture that transitions from the Bronze Age to the Iron, there's going to be a transition period, and there's no way to know how long that would take. Because some people look at that and they'll say, see, it's proof that we're in the Iron Age. But if this is like the transition period, then we may still very well be in the late Bronze Age, and that's exactly what I think we are. So, we know the story of Saul and David fairly well. David becomes his son-in-law. And as his son-in-law, what does Saul repeatedly refer to David as? David, my son. Saul considered, that's what the ancients considered these relationships, is a real relationship. And of course, David and Saul had their problems. And just like we see time and time again, a young whippersnapper who's very successful and starts to supersede his elders, there can be some trouble there. And of course, Saul had already been rejected as king. There's a lot of things that go on, and our time is beginning to wrap up here. Elamarna 2:54, for instance, says, moreover, the king wrote concerning my son. This is Labaya writing to the Pharaoh. Moreover, the king wrote concerning my son. I did not know that my son was consorting with the Habiru. I herewith hand him over to Adiah, who is apparently, an Egyptian commissioner or agent of the crown. Some people could look at that and say that he's talking about Jonathan helping out David, who in 1 Samuel 20, he gets mad at Jonathan and says, do I not know that you side with the son of Jesse? To your own shame and your mother's dishonor, as long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your royal rights are secure. It just, once again, seems to fit very well. El Amarna 2:53 says, to the king, my lord and son, thus I, Labaya, your servant, and the dirt upon which you tread, seven times and seven times do fall at the feet of the king, my lord. I have opened the orders that the king, my lord, wrote to me on a tablet. I am a servant of the king like my father and my grandfather. I am not a rebel or delinquent in my duty. Here is my act of rebellion. Here is my delinquency. When I entered Gezer, I spoke as follows. The king treats us kindly. Now, there is indeed no other purpose for me except the service of the king, and whatever the king orders, I obey. This was a letter written by Labaya, and it seems to be some time after his early letters. Because in the early letters, he's telling Pharaoh, if an ant gets struck, does he not bite the hand that struck it? He's being really sassy. Well, now he seems to be a vassal of the Pharaoh. He seems to have recognized Pharaoh and is not in rebellion anymore. At least he's claiming not to be in rebellion anymore. And this may give a kind of framework for David fleeing to the Philistines. If Saul recognizes Pharaoh and he's no longer in rebellion, then that puts David in a pretty tough spot because he would be completely surrounded by enemies if he wasn't already. So David flees and goes to the Philistines and becomes a mercenary soldier for Achish. And that relationship continues for quite some time. In Psalm 57:1, I've already noted, he's in a situation where he feels completely alone. And so that's when he goes to the Philistines. But as far as identifying Labiah as Saul, there was some pieces of evidence in particular that made it kind of sealed it for me. This is the Mediterranean looking west, and this is the Jezreel Valley, and this is the best part of Israel. This is the best farmland, the best everything. Here's Megiddo. Taanach would be over here. Jezreel is right here. Over here, there's a little town called Gina. Now, you know from reading the end of 1 Samuel and the beginning of 2 Samuel that Saul goes out to meet his enemies. He goes here, and Endor would probably be somewhere over there. He consults with the witch, finds out that all the cities are arrayed against him. And when he sees their massive chariot forces, he goes up on the heights of Gilboa. And this is Gilboa right here. And in the Amarna letters, after Labiah is killed, the Pharaoh corresponds with all these Canaanite kings, including the kings of Gath and Ekron and Ashkelon and Hazor, all the cities that you're familiar with. And they all write, and when you piece together their stories, you find out that Labiah died with his sons on Mount Gilboa. And the way this was accomplished was there were a group of Amalekites at a city called Gina. And according to the Amarna letters, they betrayed Saul. They were supposed to be his subjects, but they betrayed him. They were supposed to protect this approach. Saul had his army, or Labiah had his army here, waiting the enemies. And of course, he didn't want to fight their chariots. Gina, the men of Gina had promised to protect his rear. Well, according to the Amarna tablets, the men of Gina leave, and literally a force of archers marches straight up this nice, easy slope and starts raining arrows down on Labiah and kills Labiah and his sons. And that may give some context to what David said about the death of Saul and Jonathan at the beginning of 2 Samuel, when he calls down a curse on those heights. And I remember reading that, and I was like, well, why would you really blame the place? But there's a lot of what he says there. So David finds out how he dies, and he says, verse 19, "The beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon." And these are two of the most prominent kings who fight against Labiah, according to the Amarna letters. In fact, the whole coalition is put together by the king of Gath, which would make sense. Gath is the first city mentioned here. "Let the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. O mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew nor rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For the shield of the mighty is cast away, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep. Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with luxury, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel, how the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. You have your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war have perished. One thing he mentions in there is not only the kings that are arrayed against him, at least probably the two most powerful, but there is a chance that one thing he's talking about here could be translated the treacherous fields. When it talks about the dishonored shield, there's a way to translate that where it actually means treacherous fields, and that may be alluding to the fact that Saul was betrayed by these men, and it gets more interesting as time goes on. I think that might be one. But here was the final nail in the piece. This piece of evidence was found right as I was graduating high school in 1994. What happened to Saul's and his son's bodies after the battle? Anybody remember? Yeah, they were taken to Beth Shan and beheaded. Their bodies were hung on the wall, and Saul's head was taken on a tour of the Philistine cities. Now, in those days, if you sent a messenger to an army commander or a king, you would write it on a cylinder, and the cylinder would be hung around your neck. In Beth Shan in 1994, right after, I think, the summer of 1994, excavator at Beth Shan, archaeologist, was digging there, and he found one of these cylinder letters, and it was attached to a necktie thing, and it said, "From Tagu of Gina, Lord Labiah, I have heard your orders." And it would be interesting if that was the last message that Saul got while he was waiting on Gilboa, because if you behead somebody, anything you're wearing around your neck is just going to fall. And they apparently found this thing in situ in the middle of the city. So he died on Gilboa, both Saul and Labiah, and there's a connection with both to Beth Shan. It seems pretty obvious. After he's dead, he has two sons that survive. One goes across the Jordan, just like Ishbael does, and establishes himself in two places, Mahanaim and Pella. And then the other establishes himself somewhere else. It's not mentioned where he does. But in one of his letters, Saul's son mentions a bunch of people. This might just be the last thing we do, and then I'll open it up if you have any questions. He fires off a letter to Pharaoh, and what Pharaoh is inquiring about are the actions of someone called Ayyab. And if Ayyab is who we think it is, then it looks like we may have more evidence. But if we go through all the Amarna letters and start picking out the people that have names that are very similar to what we have in 1 and 2 Samuel, we have names like Mutbal, which means man of Baal, which is the same thing that Ishbael means, and that's one of Labiah's sons, that's the surviving son. The other surviving son is called Dadua. And remember, this is an Akkadian, it's a slightly different language, but Dadua would be David. We also have mentions of people like Aziru, whose name is short for Hadad-Ezer, or Hadad-Ezer. He's the ruler of Zobah that David would eventually conquer. We have mention of Shupak as Lupak, which both means man of Paku. Lots and lots of names that seem to correspond, including Joab, which is who one of the letters is inquiring about. So when you take everything in its totality, it just seems pretty clear that the Amarna era is the beginning of the Israelite monarchy period. All right, we are at 12:30, which is when we were designated to stop. Are there any questions or comments that you would like to make? Yes.
Did you say that the Amarna letter discussed the battle?
Yeah. Yeah, according to the Amarna letters, they sent a troop of archers up the south slope, which is very gentle. which is why Labiah wanted it protected by, there was an Amalekite enclave there that was supposed to be subject to him. And so, yeah, they sent archers and they literally just rained arrows down on him. Right. Yeah. Right.
One of the things in 1 Samuel 17 is describing Goliath's armor, wearing green.
Right.
Which they don't do
it. Classic. Which is classic Mycenaean. Yeah. And when we find names in Mycenae, or in the Philistine cities, they're straight out of Homer's Iliad. Names like Eleates and things that you could switch out with Homer, things that Homer wrote. It seems pretty obvious the pottery is Mycenaean for sure. So.
One of the things that I like to remember, this is how we know all history.
Yeah.
Not only by the book that we find, but that's the letters of people.
Right.
Insidious we find is it doesn't match. And the more advanced you get, the more verifiable the source is.
Right.
And that's true for any other time.
Right.
Again, you start calling Bible.
Yeah, it is.
You just can't. You can't know that.
Well, yeah.
How do we know
anything? Right.
By stuff like this.
Yeah. I just want to point a couple things out. I don't need this for my faith. I like it for ammunition. Because when people say that, well, archaeologists and historians have proved that the Bible's historically inaccurate, I want to be able to say, no, there is a very easily verifiable archaeological context that all these things took place in. And I'd like to find a way to explain to somebody in less than 4 hours. That would probably be helpful. But just to be able to tell people and point them in the direction of something that says, you know, the Bible's true. And that's the biggest thing. That's our biggest hurdle. That these were real people. They really happened. Yeah, they happened in a context that's outside of our experience probably. But, you know, they did really happen. The other thing I like to point out to people in relation to this is that archaeologists and scholars, they look at Babylon and they look at Assyria and they look at the Greeks and they look at the Egyptians and they go, oh, wow, what an amazing culture. Look at what they left us. Not a single one of them left us anything like the Bible. That is amazing. That is the will of God. That in and of itself proves to me that the hand of God was with the prophets and the men and women who were inspired to speak and write the Bible. The fact that Egypt, for all its valuables, couldn't produce one document like the Bible. And Israel gets no credit for that. It's amazing to hear scholars talk about it. Anything else before we close? All right, thank you for staying awake.